and not worry about the framing. Communications, I think they are here. They will deal with that, and I take a wait for your wait for it, Honorable Buthelezi Shenge and Lubabalo. You are all welcome on the platform. I see we have 37 participants so far. I welcome all of you and the support staff from both committees. Who's that now? Can you mute, please?
Yeah, sorry, Chairperson. I'm having some IT problems. The device is not unmuting. This one is muting. Thank you. I just had to check. Sorry about that, Eunice.
Okay. All right. Yeah, remember, Honorable Moss and Marahan, they had a problem of muting and unmuting. You are all welcome, Honorable Members. We have this item on the screen that you see, the bill. The focus today is going to be on the public hearing for the Division of Revenue Bill B4 2024. And we are humbly requesting that we give each other an opportunity as we present. We have received some of these, we have received the presentations or the views. We have a clue of the views of the presenters here or participants on the hearing. So please, we request that can you take 15 minutes per presentation so that we can give members an opportunity to make or engage with your presentation and what you have sent to them, and let them satisfy themselves with that. But also to members, please, let's not have more preambles and take more time in politicking or in making preambles. Let's get straight to the points. Let's engage because we understand the participants here who are going to participate in this public hearings. They took their time off their busy work to come and honor our invite. You are welcome. Can I check from Darren if there are any apologies?
Good morning, Chair. From the side of the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we haven't received any apologies up to now. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I check from Lubabalo if we have any, or Esther?
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, Co-Chair, and all honorable members present and colleagues. Chairperson, from the Select Committee on Appropriations, we received an apology from Honorable Dudoit, but he is going to join the meeting a little bit late. There's something that he still needs to address for now. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I saw that. Honorable members, let's note the apologies as presented to us and go straight to item number 3. Maximum of 15 minutes. If you can summarize less than 15 minutes, that will be okay. Now you have removed this thing. Are you putting the presentation on the screen, Lubabalo? Before we get equal education is the first one. Their presentation, or have you given them question rights?
Yes, I have given the hosting rights to Lisa.
Okay. Over to you, Equarat.
Good morning, honorable members and chairperson. This is a joint submission from Equal Education and Equal Education Law Center. Could you please give my colleague Mafuz the right? He will be presenting on our behalf this morning. I am not shaded, so it's going to be a little bit challenging. So with me this morning, I've got my colleague Mafuz Rafi. I've got Catherine Sutherland, and I've got Tatiana with me from the Law Center. Mafuz will present a summary of our submission, and then we will engage the committee members with any questions they might have. Any of us will be able to pitch in and answer. So Mafuz, over to you. Thank you.
Greetings, honorable members. I'm just checking if you can see my screen.
We can see your screen, sir, but can you put it here? It's on slide mode. It's fine.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mafuz Rafi, I'm a researcher at Equal Education, which is a social movement dedicated to the attainment of quality and equal education in South Africa. We've developed this submission in collaboration with the Equal Education Law Center, and we are very grateful to present to you. I hope it will help strengthen your oversight role, and I hope it will make sure that this year's budget meets its constitutional obligations. We contend that it does not do so, and I'll try to briefly explain why. And so when considering the budget, the government has asked to obey some key constitutional and human rights principles which underpin basic education funding in particular. And these include universality, equity, and redress. So we must make sure that education funding is responsive to things like enrollment numbers. There must be a sufficient amount of classrooms, teachers, textbooks, so that every child is accommodated. And it's important to note that the budget can't be used as an excuse to deny a child access to school, access to basic education. The Constitution also emphasizes that the government must maximize the resources available to basic education and socioeconomic rights. But the reality is that learners at many no-fee schools in particular are severely under-resourced, overcrowded, and ill-equipped. And we are afraid that these disparities will grow because of the trend of austerity coupled with the threat of privatization. And so I think it's important for me also to remind the committee that under the Constitution, most socioeconomic rights, it's subject to progressive realization within available resources. But basic education is not subject to this condition. Basic education is spelled out as an immediately realizable right. And so what this means is that any budget cuts to education or changes in spending must be subject to a greater level of scrutiny and a greater level of justification than other areas. But unfortunately, what we're hearing a lot is that you know, these cuts or fiscal consolidation, reprioritizations are being implemented across the board. And as a result of that, basic education grants and services are also thereby affected. But just as I highlighted, basic education is a unique case and must be subject to a greater level of justification than elsewhere. So really these cuts, it cannot be the case that they're being implemented, especially given the state of conditions at public schools across the country. The children of South Africa and the future of South Africa deserves better, and we need this committee to be fighting for us, please. And so what this presentation will do, it will outline some of the areas in which you could be fighting for us. But as a start, I think it's important to note that South Africa has committed itself in the UN to ring-fence the children's budget and implement greater safeguards against budget cuts in education. So ring-fencing is the first immediate step that should be taken to protect education funding. The next important step for the committees to consider is around the provincial equitable share. as this graph highlights, the allocation has been decreasing in real terms, and that's a cause of great concern because the equitable share is a huge component of education budgets. But we also think that a review of the formula is necessary to ensure that it's not just an equitable share name, it's indeed an equitable share. So the education component is currently under review, and we need Treasury to commit to a timeline, and we need them to commit to public participation and transparency over these revisions. At the moment, the education component is determined by estimates of the school going population, but that's really, it's not news enough because the cost of providing education to a school in, for example, rural Eastern Cape is very different to those in a well-resourced suburb in a metropole. So the provincial equitable share needs to be more explicitly equitable, needs to better account for things like the cost of scholar transport, the cost of building infrastructure in rural areas where supply chains are different. And it also especially needs to account for the quintile system. So for example, just 40% of schools in the Western Cape are no-fee schools in quintile 1, 2, 3. But 77% of schools in Limpopo are no-fee schools. So this is a serious problem if you're determining provinces' shares just per learner, but you're not taking into account the relative circumstances of those learners. And yes, there is a poverty component separate to the education component in the provincial equitable share that sort of is meant to also correct for some of this. But the poverty component's only given a 3% weighting of the fund. So definitely not enough weight is given to equity and redress and that poverty component. And we believe that the weight should be increased there as well. Another thing to highlight, so like these cuts to the provincial equitable share, the real cuts that I spoke about in the previous slide, one example of how it's hurting provinces and hurting education is in KwaZulu-Natal. This is a letter that was written by some of our members to the KZN legislature after the provincial budget last year. And so you see that in their budget, the province runs, it uses kind of similar language to national treasury or fiscal consolidation and trying to run a budget surplus. But poor learners are facing a massive funding deficit. According to the province, it can only afford a per learner subsidy of 955 Rand per learner at no fee schools. But according to the Gazette, the norms and standards for school funding recommend a minimum per learner threshold subsidy of 1,672. So it's a huge, serious underfunding given to poor learners. Another example of a problematic area, and we've been highlighting this for several years now, is school infrastructure. I don't think I have got enough time to go through the slide in depth, but it comes straight from a presentation that was given by the Department of Basic Education to a committee in Parliament last year, and it sort of outlines the costs involved if it was to achieve the norms and standards for school infrastructure by 2030. I should note that all of these items were meant to be completed by 2023. But really, when we're looking at these costs and we're looking at the state of underfunding, and we don't know when that will happen. According to the Department of Basic Education, if you wanted to eradicate all of these infrastructure backlogs by 2030, it would need an annual investment of about 40 billion Rand per year. And then these backlogs would be completed within 77 years. But there's fiscal consolidation, there's austerity, and there's just not enough money apparently. So they've tried to develop a strategy to alleviate the most pressing backlogs, and that's priority one, schools made entirely of inappropriate materials, priority two, schools with no toilets, and then just 50% of some of the other priorities around water, sanitation, and additional classrooms, and also the priority on secure perimeter fencing. So to eliminate just those really very basic backlogs, it would need a minimum investment of 19.7 billion Rand per year, eliminate them entirely, just eliminate 50% of the ones highlighted in yellow. And so So currently the education infrastructure grant is at 13.7 billion rand, and as I highlighted before, provinces don't really have much money from the equitable share to top up on that spending. And so this is drastically under low to meet even the most basic infrastructure requirements, as highlighted by this plan. And so our recommendation is that the education infrastructure grant be increased by 6 billion to 19.7 billion rand, and that would lead it to be able to implement this plan, but only eliminate 50% of the backlogs that are highlighted in yellow. There's also another grant that's meant to alleviate pressing infrastructure backlogs, particularly in sanitation, inappropriate material safety, and classroom building. So that would be the school infrastructure backlogs grant. But that's also received significant cuts in the MTF, and we demand that these cuts be reversed, and that actually this grant be increased to 6 billion rand per annum, and then that would give the government and the Department of Basic Education enough to meet the minimum requirements from priority 1 to 3D, as well as priority 4E, which is perimeter fencing. Of course, the ideal scenario is that you know, there'd be much more than that. We'd be able to invest in things that really help learning, like libraries, computer centers, etc. Right now, we're just asking for the bare minimum. It would really be so that kids could go to schools with safe buildings and working toilets and schools that are not overcrowded. And so these grants urgently need to be increased. Yes, this is just outlining the recommendations of that grant. Really, when you look at the conditions of schools, it's deeply necessary. The next important grant funding and recommendations that we have is around early childhood development. The trajectory that is due to reprioritization and budget cuts, you can see that compared to last year's February budget, the trajectory is significantly lower than what it was previously. And we see part of that is due to reprioritization into national pilot program for nutrition, example. But really, that should have been additional funding, not reprioritized funds. I don't want to harbor on too much about the cost, because it's already from a low base as well. But these are programs of national importance, and we need to plan better so that workers in these programs earn living wages, that the centers are really equipped to provide proper nurturance and stimulation to young children. The current ECD per child subsidy is at 17 Rand. That's way too low. It's been frozen there since 2019, while costs have increased dramatically, especially the cost of food, as you all know. So this needs to be adjusted, and we recommend that it grows to 46 Rand per eligible learner by 2029. Also, the infrastructure component of the grant is too low at 147 million Rand. There's thousands of ECD centers around the country, and they serve primarily children from low-income households, and they really need support so that their centers are fit and proper to be registered, and so they can deliver ECD services in line with norms and standards. And I'm sure I don't need to stress to you, but that there's a vast array of research that's been done, which emphasizes the importance of the first 5 years of a child's life to their development, and also research that shows how bigger investments into ECD now can save costs on education, healthcare, and other components of the sales wage later. So I hope this will be given due consideration and increases will be made to this grant. Another area, components of the budget that are distributed to provinces is the learner-teacher support materials. We know there have been significant cuts to LTSM workbooks. I won't dwell too long on this. We're cautioning against this because it's likely to backfire learners with the inferior quality workbooks. There's cost-cutting measures in printing and distribution. So these workbooks are unlikely to be able to last learners or be usable for the full year. So we caution against these cuts. If they can only use the workbooks for a few months, or even worse, if there's problems with distribution, and they don't receive the workbooks, that's a serious impediment to their education, and it's a big risk that should not be taken. Likewise, with the National School Nutrition Program, we welcome that there are increases currently in line with food inflation estimates, but we just caution that the projected food inflation estimates assume that food inflation will come back down significantly very soon. And given the recent spikes to food prices and problems that we've seen over the years with supply chains, procurement, and the lack of provision of fresh food, we just want to emphasize that, that funding to this grant should be protected as best as possible. And then there's teacher training. Notably, there have been serious problems with the Funza Lushaka bursary scheme. Just two, three years ago, over 13,000 students were funded by this program. Today, it's dropped by about a third. Only 9,000 students are on the program. And there are plans to bring it back to just over 10,000 over the MTF. But these plans, they're not really consistent. For example, one of the strategies is to find more post-grad PGCE student teachers, but some PGCE students were recently cut from the program during their time of study. And so we're calling for these cuts to be reversed so that they can receive their bursaries again. But also, I think the most sustainable solution to this is to ensure that there's sufficient funding so that people don't unduly use their bursaries, and also so that we can provide enough teachers to keep education service delivery afloat. We know that lots of teachers are scheduled to retire, and that schools already, as they are significantly overcrowded. So the importance of training and employing more teachers cannot be understated. And this area of funding should be emphasized as well. And then lastly, just a note on the Presidential Youth Employment Initiative. I think this item has moved to, it's not allocated to a particular vote anymore. But the budget review said that only about 4 billion rand will be allocated to the education sector employment initiative. And so as we can see, that would be a significant cut of almost 2.5 billion rand. And we strongly want to advise against this. The program has been tremendously successful under a number of metrics, including job creation, household spending, and so economic stimulus. But as I said before, schools are overcrowded, teachers are overburdened, and this employment scheme really would benefit the education sector, which is in dire need. So we're calling for a reversal of those cuts and an expansion of this program, actually. Yeah, I won't go through all the recommendations. I've touched on most of them already. I think the key thing to highlight is that education spending is in a very precarious position. Education service delivery relied on government funding, but there have been cuts and cost containment measures, which have really hampered the ability of the government to meet the prescribed norms and standards for infrastructure, as well as the prescribed norms and standards for funding. And so it's our position that the level of funding allocated is unconstitutional. And we hope that you will undertake a proper assessment of the budget against the needs of school learners, and that this will help you institute measures to protect the education budget, to increase allocations to provinces through the equitable share and also through conditional grants. And this will help us build a better, more prosperous future for all. Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to engaging.
Thank you very much for that presentation. I'm also appreciating that you have observed the time as requested. And we now go to the second presentation, that is Public Service Accountability Monitor.
Good morning, Chair. I'm just struggling to share my screen. Okay, I see it's turned. Can we try again?
Can someone have a secretary?
Yes, okay, I think it's the co-host, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. Just waiting for my screen to catch up here. Sorry, good morning. Good morning, Chair. Good morning to the honourable members and others on the platform this morning. My name is Lisa Higginson, and I'm the Budget Advocacy Coordinator at PSAM, or the Public Service Accountability Monitor. We are a civil society organisation based at Rhodes University. Our activities include research, monitoring, advocacy, and capacity building. So working throughout Southern Africa, we generate and share knowledge about social accountability and advocate for more open, participatory, and accountable government. And just to emphasize, we speak a lot about social accountability, and here this places an explicit duty on government to justify decisions and performance regarding the use of public resources. And this is the emphasis or the focus of our presentation today. So just a quick outline, we'll go through some of the frameworks for the adjustments budget. We raise concerns about the increasing frequency of additional adjustments. Our main concern is around the insufficient information regarding these additional adjustments. We outline some concerns, some impacts and implications, and a few recommendations. So we had a look at the various frameworks that govern the budget process. We were specifically looking for provisions for a second adjustment or additional adjustment budget. And so we looked at the Public Finance Management Act, and there we see that the minister can table an adjustments budget when necessary, so it's fairly open, but there are some conditions, mostly around there being significant and unforeseeable circumstances, and there are some quite specific conditions. Similarly, in the National Treasury regulations, the National Treasury guidelines specify some of the information that needs to accompany budget decisions and adjustments. The Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act looks at the actual process of passing these bills. The Appropriations Act also has a number of quite specific, sorry, I'm just going to close the window. Some quite specific guidelines and parameters for the changes. The Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. And so what we find is that there's very little very specific guidance that relates to a second or an additional adjustment appropriation. So we assume that then the conditions that are specified for the adjustments budget should apply to any adjustment that takes place, whether that's the typical adjustment that takes place with the MTBPS or a second or additional adjustment, as they're sometimes called. So we question whether these additional adjustments have been tested against these frameworks and whether sufficient guidance is provided in the frameworks. What we note is an increasing frequency of an additional budget, additional adjustment. So we look back from 2011-2012, and we see there that there was a significant additional adjustment. That was for the Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project. That was 5.75 billion. And then no additional adjustment budget for the next sort of 8 years or so. And then we had the COVID period where there were some special appropriations, supplementary budgets, additional adjustments. And 21-22, there were some quite significant adjustments that were for drawing funds from the SASRIA to cover the damage caused in the July riots and for the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. And then we see in 22-23 and 23-24 that there were two quite significant second adjustment appropriation bills tabled with the main budget in February. So I seem to remember, unfortunately it's not on the slide there, but in 22-23 it was about 9 billion rands worth of adjustments and affecting about 40 votes. So I think it was almost every vote except for water taxation. This year it's about 9 votes affected, and although the net sort of value of the adjustment is zero, about 470 million rand worth of capital. So there's very clearly a trend here that, you know, that this is becoming more frequent based on the last 2 years and based on the fact that it wasn't really the case over the preceding years. This is something fairly new, a new trend, something that's changed. We believe that there's insufficient information provided with these additional adjustments. Just taken a snapshot there from the bill itself. And we see there that there's very little information. So we can see the vote that it applies to and the purpose of that vote. We can see the economic classification and we can see the program, but it doesn't actually say why this was necessary, what this adjustment was for. We fortunately were able to access the Parliamentary Budget Office presentation, which did include some further explanation. So from what we understand, based on what's up on the screen there, the adjustments to the presidency vote were for the Ministry of Electricity in cooperative government, vote 3. That adjustment, the reduction of 400 million, as you can see there, is for the community work program, but the reason for the reduction was that there was a delay in appointing implementing agents. So this information is not apparent in the bill itself. We didn't find it in the budget review or any of the documents that were tabled with the budget. And as we understand, the information was sourced from various documents, including the annual performance plans and other documents. And we just can't really understand why this is the case. Those who drafted the bill would have a clear understanding of why these adjustments take place. Well, they certainly should, because there are frameworks that apply to how these changes take place, and we don't understand how anybody could check whether these are in line with those frameworks and with the conditions if there isn't more sufficient information provided. So we question there as well, what does this mean for participation and oversight? The information provided here is just simply not enough to understand the justification. This just doesn't meet our expectations. And the very good sort of routine information that is usually published with the budget and with the main adjustments bill that takes place in October, there's a great deal of information that's included there. So our point here being that the information is just not sufficient. So there are some concerns as well. When we look at what the bill actually contains, there's a 400 million rand reduction to the community works program, 8 million reduction to the extended public works program, 50 million rand reduction to the property and construction industry policy and research program in the Department of Public Works. And these are quite concerning given what we know about unemployment and poverty in the country, that we see such large reductions these critical programs, and given what we've seen to the rollout of infrastructure, that we're seeing such a large reduction to this, we think should be quite a critical function. So again, we sort of left guessing to understand exactly what the justifications are, and based on what's in the presentation from the Parliamentary Budget Office, it seems as though these sort of unspent funds, mostly due to delayed appointments of implementing agents, were used to offset the additional funds that were added to the Ministry of Electricity, for example, to the Representative Political Party Fund, and various others. So we question, is this within the framework? Are these significant and unforeseeable events? And there's some other quite specific sort of conditions about when savings can be used within a budget, whether they can be shifted to another within another vote, etc. It's unclear to us whether this has been considered. And overall, we just, you know, from the bill itself, what we see is a shift from those who rely on government employment programs earning a small stipend you know, this is almost a life support to them. Some of these shifts were being made to cover compensation of employees and in other votes. And we're not sure that this is really fair. We looked at some of the impacts and implications, mostly of the insufficient information rather than the actual content of the bill. And we think that the lack of transparency goes against the good practice demonstrated to date. South Africa is one of the top achieving countries in the Open Budget Survey. Our transparency record is celebrated. And this tabling of the second adjustment bill, appropriation bill, just it doesn't meet the standard. And we want to emphasize that there's a difference in the explanations required for the main appropriation and adjustment. So although the bill does show the purpose of the funding of the funds or the purpose of the vote or of the program, it doesn't justify the reason for the adjustment that's taking place. We think this has an impact on formal oversight and social accountability monitoring. It risks a more fragmented budget process. The budget process is already quite complicated, and now what we are seeing is a quite regular second or additional adjustment that is taking place in February with just a few weeks to go until the end of the financial year. We note that the spending is then allowed to continue until the end of May, but this creates a bit more complexity. Departments who are already struggling with their financial management and reporting are now having to follow two streams of funding from two different financial years at once as the overlap sort of between March and May takes place, and this is a bit concerning. So we really think that this needs to be addressed, especially if this is going to be a trend that year after year we'll see the second adjustment taking place for situations that we're not quite convinced are completely unforeseen. And we also note with concern that this was a recommendation by the committee last year to the National Treasury to include more information based on the input from the Financial and Fiscal Commission, who had also noted that there was just insufficient information in the bill to conduct oversight. So our recommendations, our intention is not to create an overly restricted and inflexible budget process. We understand that that we are living in quite curious times, things are changing, things are quite uncertain, and there are decisions that need to be made. But we do argue that justifications and explanations must be included with the additional adjustments. So in this case, it's called the second adjustment. But as we said in the past, there have been additional adjustments, appropriation bills tabled as well. We think Treasury should be asked to explain why this is taking place, to show that these are truly unforeseen events. We think that the process should be tested against the framework to protect budget credibility. We think that detailed explanatory information must be included in the adjustments. And we are also calling for further interrogation of the second adjustment appropriation bill for 2023-24. And that brings me to the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Can we go to the next presenter? Which is a Rural Health Advocacy Project. Over to you.
Thank
you. You are doing
so
well with you in terms of time. Thank you so much. Over to you.
Thank you. Can I please share my screen? It still says I can't share.
So Godfred, can you help, please?
Yes, the rights have been conferred. She can share now.
Okay, yes, thank you. Okay.
All right. Good morning, honorable members, and to you all, comrades. I am Zimbini Matikiza. I work at the Rural Health, at the Rural Advocacy Project as an outreach and training coordinator. I am from Kwapeng, one of the rural areas in Mthatha. I'm also a public health care user. So today, I will be outlining the importance of the budget. The budget actually funds things that makes people's lives easy. So I will be touching on the importance of good coordination and prioritization of budget allocations for improving health outcomes for rural communities. So health budget needs to speak to the realities of the past and the future for improved health system. It is really encouraging to see Minister Korongana make direct references to health, introducing budgeting initiatives that will tackle some of the most pressing challenges. But this is only the first step, and in general, more detail is needed to ensure that people's constitutional health rights are initially realized. As we know that budgets are actually allocated to realize and their constitutional obligations. So health needs for rural communities have changed since the establishment of the National Health Act 61 of 2003, as this is the act framework and regulation for the provision of equitable access to healthcare. So we need to reassess realities of the past and the future. Current budgets are actually designed to still speak to the health needs communities had about 21 years ago, as the Department of Health derives its budget mandate from the National Health Act of 2003. We need to make sure that current budget divisions do speak to the improvement of health system in general. We are happy that the minister has made provision for the improvement of data health information system, including digital patient filing. Because when we do outreach work and we go visit facilities with the comrades on the ground, when we enter the facility in the registration area, you could see piles of files, and they would tell you that files are getting lost. So they were also recommending that we need a digital patient filing. We also need to make sure that infrastructure and human resource provisions are prioritized for rural communities. And most importantly, as we are speaking of universal health coverage, and we are declaring that primary healthcare services are a vehicle in terms of achieving universal health coverage, then that means primary healthcare services need to be prioritized. Oh my God, technology, what are you doing to me? So we need to prioritize healthcare for rural communities. Budgets need to make it a point that they speak to prioritization of healthcare provision for rural communities. So we need great coordination of this budget. So as you're speaking to achieving universal health coverage, the Rural Health Advocacy Project research team have conducted a desktop literature review to assess and highlight the progress of where are we when it comes to achieving universal health coverage in rural districts that REP works at. The information on this research was obtained from the district health barometers, from the South African Health Review, and from the provincial annual financial reports. And these briefs can be found on our website. So basically, what is universal health coverage? Why do we say we need to achieve universal coverage, and why do we need primary health care? The indicators that are outlined in the universal health for us to achieve universal health coverage speaks to the primary health care needs of the rural communities. So there are about four priority universal health indicators that we also outlined on our research briefs done for the achievement of universal health coverage. So the first and the very critical component is the reproductive, child, and maternal health. So our report here basically shows that access to family planning is a very crucial component in primary healthcare and in reducing maternal and child mortality. According to the recently published District Health Barometer 2022-2023, we still have high rates of maternal mortality. This is because pregnant women present very late for antenatal care at the facilities, and we believe that investment in healthcare workforce will definitely address this problem. The other indicator speaks on the infectious diseases such as HIV and TB. We recognize that there is a great need, there is a great progress that have been done in initiating HIV positive people, but we also recognize that we need more attention to the TB deaths. The other indicator speaks to the non-communicable diseases. On our research, we look at the diabetes, which is the second leading cause of death in South Africa following TB. So the budget needs to make it a point that there is investment in addressing this health problem for rural communities, which means that we need more screening, and routine testing is key for rural communities for this diabetes and for early detection and prevention of the onset of diabetes. So again, we need investment in healthcare worker program, which will be very beneficial for this cause and other healthcare workforce in need for rural communities. The fourth universal healthcare coverage indicator speaks to service capacity and access. So in our report, we touch on the fact that in South Africa and at a primary healthcare level, this indicator would look at the implementation of the ideal clinics. So for an ideal clinic to be classified, for a clinic to be classified as an ideal clinic, that healthcare establishment must have good infrastructure, it must have adequate staffing that is in need for rural communities, that speaks to the healthcare needs for rural communities. We need to not have stock outs of things like your antiretrovirals, things like your contraception, which speaks to the issue of adequate medicines and supply. We need good administrative process, which will lead to great coordination of resources, including health products, including finances, that speak to the needs of the rural health communities. So we, in terms of access to quality healthcare for rural communities, we acknowledge the provincial additional budget allocations, including for Department of Health as well. But we emphasize that we need good governance for great coordination of this budget. We welcome the recent filling of the medical officer posts. We have seen that unemployed doctors took to the streets, and then this initiative was taken to fill this recent post. So we need to use the same opportunity to address the maladministration of rural health posts and prioritize filling of the rural posts as suggested on the 2030 National Human Resources for Health Strategy. The issue of prioritizing rural healthcare posts will speak on the provision of quality access, quality care for primary healthcare in rural communities. An effective coordination of this budget is important because the goal of these allocations is to make sure that the constitutional obligations of everyone living in South Africa are met, as also stated on Section 27 of the South African Constitution. We can't emphasize the issue of effective coordination of the available budget. And this will improve access to healthcare for rural communities because there will be prioritization of funds being administered according to the health needs of the rural communities. Rural health needs are mainly access to primary healthcare services at local clinics and district hospitals. So more investment in health is still needed if we want to successfully achieve universal health coverage. So in working in collaboration with the duty bearers, here are our recommendations. Is to call a joint sitting of the Portfolio Committee of Health, Finance and Appropriations to consider how to prioritize budgets for state's ability to meet its constitutional mandates. It is to call all provinces to present plans detailing what measures are being implemented to ensure that rural health services are protected from any budget cuts. It's also to call on the National Department of Health to outline what plans are put in place for the implementation of the 2030 National Human Resources for Health Strategy, especially the components that speaks to rural communities. As I have stated, the budget allocations must speak to the constitutional obligations as outlined in this, the Section 27 of the Constitution, so as to be able to implement the National Health Act, and also to see if do we need to review the National Health Act so that it speaks to the realities of today.
Nkosi, thank you so much. We now give over to, we'll request the Rural TB Accountability Monitor to take the platform. I hope you have given them the hosting rights.
Not yet. We don't know. I don't know who is going to be sharing. I'll be giving them the right just now.
It is I.
Who?
Sihle
Mahonga.
Oh, Sihle. I think you are the co-host, Sihle.
Yes.
You are already, yeah. Thank you, Sihle.
Thank you very much. My screen currently says that my participant sharing has been disabled.
Okay, let me redo. It's done, as you say. Check again.
Thank you very much. Yes, it is.
Yes, thank you.
A very good morning, honourable members and honourable chair, as well as to the fellow comrades also doing their presentations this morning. My name is Sihle Mahonga, the TB Accountability Consortium Project Officer. That is a point of correction in terms of being a monitor. We are a consortium. We are, in fact, a coalition of a growing platform that seeks to improve accountability measures within South Africa's TB response. And this morning's presentation will be on the continued resilience in funding accountability. We are obviously seeing a health system in transit, and we are also seeing also a leadership in transit. And so we are wanting for there to be a continued resilience within that transition happening. So just to give a more macro understanding of tuberculosis globally and then coming to the micro, within our country. According to the World Health Organization, their 2023 Global TB Report states that tuberculosis is the second leading cause of death of an infectious disease. And in our country, around 280,000 people get infected with the disease. And of that, 152,000 are people living with HIV. And since we have also had COVID happening within 2020, we have actually had a stalling and a regression in some instances globally in terms of our sustainable development goals, our UN high-level meeting declarations that were met, that had been agreed upon in 2018, as well as some of our goals in our country within our national development plans, as well as our newly released national strategic plan on HIV, AIDS, TB, and STIs. As a result of COVID, our country actually had devised a TB program intervention to address care cascade loss and accelerate efforts. And this was done in four key interventions: to find people with TB, to treat those who have been diagnosed with tuberculosis, and then to retain those who are on treatment into care, and then those who have been in contact with those with tuberculosis to be put on TB preventative therapy. So TB services on a national level is mainly, at a provincial level, is mainly provided in provincial budgets. As we know, implementation of healthcare services actually happens within your provinces and your district services. And the allocations of this fall mainly within the district health services grant, as well as another grant which goes under primary healthcare services. And this is within the provincial equitable share. And so we also note and welcome the increase of this district health services allocation from 113 billion in 2023 to 120 billion in this fiscal year. We also note within the NHI grant that there has been a grant focus on health system information. In this grant, there was a proposal that there would be a strengthening of health management and information systems, as well as other infrastructure elements within what they're proposing within the National Health Insurance Bill. And we understand that this is something that is of importance, that we actually have a strengthened patient information system. We also understand the importance that good data leads to good governance. And so we do welcome this. But as we welcome these things, there is also apparent things that are at stake. So what is at stake? Well, the first one is the apparent fiscal constraints. In the 2022-2023 MCBPS, we see a downward trajectory to 0.6 from 0.8 during this period. And so we see this fiscal squeeze or significant fiscal consolidation that my fellow comrades are also expressing sentiments over. And so the implications of this are that unless TB program budgets are protected, it is unclear that people who require TB services will be able to get access to this important health need. If we are having more or slightly more than half of those of people living with HIV still needing access to TB services, then I think this is an apparent need that needs to be addressed. The second thing that is at stake is obviously the TB performance or program performance. We see that there has been a marginal decrease within the TB mortality rates within the 2022 and 2023 period, from 56,000 deaths to 54,000 deaths. But we still do hearken the sentiment that 54,000 deaths is 54,000 way too many. In our UHC fact sheets that were actually published by the Rural Health Advocacy Project within our fact sheets that were published last year, we see the worrying trend of those who have other comorbidities or co-infections, such as diabetes, having a higher likelihood of not completing treatment. And so we call on that tuberculosis is not just integrated within HIV and AIDS alone, but that we have a TB multi-morbidity health policy that is actually put in place so that people who actually have tuberculosis and other diseases actually can have allocations that actually deal with these needs. And so better reporting on TB plans and the exploration of ring fencing of TB budgets is important in ensuring adequate funding to accelerate, firstly, TB testing, which is something that we're needing to still find people who have TB, as well as those who have either gone off their TB treatment to go back onto their treatment, or those who have already been diagnosed to continue on into linkage to care. Further considerations are obviously that we have a pending leadership configuration come June. And come June, regardless of who will be in power, we still hold those under what the Constitution affords. And the Constitution affords everyone to have equal enjoyment of rights, the social determinants to rights, and access to care. And that health funding under the National Health Act also says that national and provincial legislation is framed by the rights and duties and principles of governance and financial management that is established by the Constitution, and this is regardless of who will be elected. The National Health Act further expands in Section 3, directing the Minister to strive in the protection, promotion, improvement, and maintenance of health for the population. Second consideration is the need for coordinated action, priority, and transparency, that although there has been an improvement in TB program performance overall, we are still left with a national TB recovery plan that still has no clear provincial and district levels. And it is imperative for implementing a program aimed at diminishing TB's grip on our communities, especially those who are actually affected by tuberculosis, which are Black and poor communities, absolutely remains critical. And so for our key requests as the consortium is sustained resilience. And these are in 3 points. We are asking for the safeguarding of TB funding within these decreased district health services allocation. The government possesses the authority to safeguard funding for TB services, and this also includes the TB recovery plan. And despite the development of the plan, there is still a lack of provisioning and implementation at provincial and district level. The second is enhancing accountability. We know that there's obviously these resources that have been allocated, but how well do we know they're going to be used effectively? And this needs to be something that needs to be communicated at national and then be translated within your provincial and district levels. The third one is obviously that we're needing a multi-sectoral response within this. That we understand, as you've previously mentioned in our submissions, that obviously this is a health need, but without allocations within these health interventions, people continue to die. And so we ask for a response that is a collaborative one within civil society in collaboration with that of the committee, the Portfolio Committee of Health. Lastly, we entreat in line with the global TB theme, which is yes, you and I can end TB. And we say, no, we cannot end TB without the adequate resources. We ask that you put our citizens first in guaranteeing more lives are saved with adequate health services. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Sikle, for the presentation and also observing time. Can I now request the Western Cape Children's Commission to make their presentation? Over to you, madam.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, fellow presenters, hopefully the National Treasury as well. I'm Christina Nomdu, the Western Cape Commissioner for Children. I'm co-presenting with Leanda. She will introduce herself while I attempt to put our presentation online.
Good morning to everyone. My name is Leanda Sogoyega. I am 17 years of age, and I come from Kwanokutula in Plettenberg Bay under the Bido municipality. I am a part of the Western Cape Children's Commissioner's Office, and I serve as a child monitor and an advisor to the commissioner. I've been with the commissioner since 2021, during the COVID times. So I'll be presenting on our national budget feedback. So the Western Cape Children's Commissioner calls for the development of a child-centered and child-friendly governance system. The consideration of debt burden on children and the consideration of the proposed state reconfiguration. However, we will not be presenting on this topic today. To avoid cuts to social sector spending, and bolster child welfare and child protection budgets. Child-centered means the topic is focused on children and speaks about them. Child-friendly means a child can understand the content and won't have a difficult time understanding. These are the words of Imi Vuyo, one of our child monitors in the office. Children analyzed the budget speech, the infographic, and the PowerPoint, and we concluded that the documents were not child-friendly. Child-friendly does not just mean colorful. These are the words of John Lee, a monitor in the office as well. National Treasury has approached the Western Cape Commissioner's Office to make budget information more child-friendly. Child-centered budgeting requires application of more technical expertise.
Okay, so I think that we are serious in the Western Cape Commissioner for Children's Office to enable children to participate in this very complicated budget process, as our colleagues in PSAM has noted. So we've worked with the children to understand and to make substantive submissions on the provincial and national MTBPS, and that's nice to get children to engage on its words, its sentiments, and so they can give their sentiments in return. We then looked at the first adjustments budget in provincial parliament and were very disturbed at the fact that there was so much cutting of in-year spending on conditional grants for especially children's services, infrastructure grants. I think Equal Education Law Centre has noted all the cuts for grants in the education sector. We listened to the SONA, the SOPA, and then we listened to the national and provincial budget speeches and tried to even analyze these budgets with children. Furthermore, yesterday we started to sit into our provincial budget votes. We will focus this year on the health and social development budget vote in Western Cape. And the reason why we are doing this is to try to get children to actually be part of budget analysis. So we have a current campaign called hashtag child budget analysis and hashtag follow the money. So children will work in partnership with the Department of Health in the province to go into communities, starting at the primary healthcare sites and understanding where the money comes from national to provincial into their local communities and their services. We want child-centered and child-friendly budgets in order to realize children's rights.
Moving on to the debt burden on us. We as the children, we are relieved that the VAT rate was not increased. We appreciate the climate change takes. It serves them right. They are damaging our environment and killing nature. These are the words of me as a child monitor. We as the children are, however, concerned about the drawdown from the Reserve Bank. Early access to the retirement pension is also a concern. We as the children are worried that we will have to pay high taxes and look after financially vulnerable parents in future.
So in order to make the budget story, understandable by children, we have to tell that story from that policy statement right into all these budget books, the estimates of national expenditure, the appropriations bill. And so I tell the story as a continued story from our presentation when we made our submission on the MTBPS. So this debt burden was one of the issues that we picked up there, and we looked at it in the current budget. Where is the revenue coming from, and how will the revenue of the country be spent?
We were happy about the inflationary increases to social grants. My nana, meaning grandma, was very happy. These are the words of Isabella, a monitor in the office. As the Western Cape Children's Commissioner's Office, we note the marginal increase of most conditional grants in the social sector. The decrease in the foster care grant allocation and national health insurance grant is confusing, though.
So we understand the difference between nominal increases, the numbers in the budget books, and real increases or actually decreases, as the case may be, because we don't see inflationary increases across the board. This is very important if we want to have the same level of service delivery out there. We need to make sure that the allocations stay abreast with inflation. So we've just noted two nominal figures that we were concerned about. And, you know, we get involved in these discussions, these forums, so that we can draw other people who are technical experts closer to us, those in government, international and provincial treasury, and also our fellow presenters. This is a call for you to help me to explain the budget to children where we are ourselves confused.
We as children understand that provinces receive most of their money from national government. The Western Cape Finance MEC noted that the census done in 2022 re-ranked the Western Cape as the third largest province by population size, not the current fifth ranking. As the Western Cape's Children's Commissioner, we wish to understand if the equitable share formula will be amended as a result.
I heard one of the other presenters talk about I assume it's the Financial and Fiscal Commission who sits on that equitable share formula. So we would also like to learn about that equitable share formula, how it is developed, how it will shift with the growing demands in every province. So we really want to understand when the formula will be adjusted, if it will be adjusted, how it will be adjusted, who can we speak to about this?
In conclusion, allow me to repeat the calls for child-friendly and child-centered budgets, the consideration of debt burden on children, the increase in social sector spending to bolster the child well-being and child protection budgets.
So we always put together a written submission, and that written submission is available from us. We have written submissions, like I say, of several budget processes that we've been involved in. But when we make presentations, we like to make presentations that our children also can understand. So this presentation, in its very simple format, is endorsed by the children in the Western Cape Commissioner for Children's Office. And again, my invitation to please partner with us to also make younger children, younger people in the society, part of our budget process. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And did you say you're 17 or 19?
17.
17. And you started when you were?
It was 21, so I was 3 years younger, which is
14. We have children as young as 12 years old that participate on our forums.
That's very
budget analysis.
Very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Che.
Can you then give an opportunity to Amanda Mobi?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning. If I could be made co-host, please, so I can share my screen. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair and everybody in the room. Thank you so much for allowing us yet another opportunity to come before this committee and present our and the people's views on the budget tabled by Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana. My name is Zoe Seopa. I am a senior campaigner at Amandla.mobi. Amandla.mobi is a community organization that focuses on the needs of, you know, ordinary people, everyday people, and we do campaigns on various issues that affect the most marginalized in this country. And for the past 4 years, if not 5 years now, we have been coming to this committee with our presentations. Some of you, I think, know them for, you know, having all these videos and voice notes and so on. And over the past years, you know, every time after the budget is tabled, we have seen a decline in, you know, in the interest of the people in the budget. People are getting a little defeated, people are losing hope, people are losing faith, you know, in the government, in our leaders, in national treasury. And what is really most difficult for us is to come to, you know, these submissions, these public hearings every year, and having to, you know, welcome all these interventions that are announced, such as, you know, the increases on some of the social grants, the extension of the 350 grant to March 2027, and so on. These are all really good. These show that the National Treasury, the government, is trying. But what is really disappointing is to have to move from this slide and then go to analyzing it and being critical that, you know, although we do have these increases, they are still not enough. Every year before the budget, we present our demands to National Treasury, and these are not the demands that come from us, the people who work from Amandla Bemobi, but the people on the ground, you know, the people who are dealing with unemployment and poverty and the high cost of living every single day. And it really just disappointing that Treasury continues to hit and miss each and every year. And of course, this is where we begin speaking in detail about social grants, which to this day still remain an important source of income and lifeline for millions of households in South Africa. Every time there's increases on grants, there are never enough amounts to match the financial needs of a person living in South Africa. The more that is given is never enough to deal with the more that people have to, you know, deal with every single day of their life. Every time National Treasury makes decisions that make social grants inadequate, it undermines the purpose of these grants, and it pushes the country steps back and people into more poverty. Between 2018 and now, inequality, poverty, and unemployment has only gone up. The household food basket, honorable members, has increased to more than 5,000, with more people experiencing hunger each year. So we want to know if this committee agrees with how National Treasury has been allocating funds for social grants, and if this committee sees that as progressively moving towards better life situations for many South Africans in this country. Again, honorable members, countless of individuals and civil society groups have stressed many times that the 350 grant is not enough. It needs to be increased, but to this day, it still hasn't. Since its inception in May 2020, the cost of living has skyrocketed. Food and other basic needs have increased in price, and millions of people cannot afford basic necessities as they struggle to put food on the table. The 350 grant now buys less than it could in 2020. The budget does not allocate enough funds to increase the 350 grant or provide it to more people, let alone allocate funds to turn it into a basic income grant. Finance Minister Gordon Gwanah stated that the new grant and value will be known when the Social Development Minister Lindiwe Zulu publishes new regulations. But how can there be a new value if Treasury has not allocated additional funds to increase the grant? The grant regulations also continue to make it difficult for people to qualify, with discrepancies that see those who do get excluded due to the means testing. The extension to March 2027 is a step in the right direction, but National Treasury needs to do better and improve the grant by first increasing it and urgently turning it into a basic income grant. Honourable members, in the last year, rising food prices have meant that the cost to feed a child a basic nutritious meal has increased by 74 rand, and right now it costs just over 900 to feed a child a nutritious diet. So the 530 rand grant is not enough. The children of Mzansi need more money to lead healthy lives. It is encouraging that some political parties have come out to support major increases for the child support grant and extending it to include pregnant women. We, however, remind parties that actions speak louder than words. Honourable members, as you know, the Goggles, so we did ask them to send us their voice notes this year, again, commenting on the budget. And you could just hear in their voices that they're defeated. You know, the high level of employment has meant that pensioners have to carry the burden of caring for a household at the expense of their own needs. The monthly cost of nutritious food, as I said, is over 5,000. And according to research, low-income households headed by older persons often spend less than half that amount on food because of other household expenses. If more money is not allocated to solve issues around unemployment, around service delivery, around the high cost of living, and these inadequate grant amounts, senior citizens will continue carrying the problems of this country on their shoulders and in turn sacrificing themselves. Honourable members, the government has promised the BIG for over 2 years now, with the president saying in his asana that work is underway to develop a targeted basic income support in South Africa. Minister Godongwana also said in his budget speech that work is underway to improve the 350 grants. We can only assume that this is work towards turning the 350 grant into a BIG, but this needs to be clarified considering there are still no clear plans for implementing the BIG. The time for vague comments about the BIG is over, honourable members. It is time for commitment. The people deserve to know when and how the BIG will be implemented. Multiple research suggests that a wealth tax is possible and could help fund the BIG. Several political parties have also come out to support the need for a BIG. In fact, almost all members of this committee are from parties who support a BIG, and that includes the ANC, the EFF, and the DA. Need we remind you that, again, actions speak louder than words. We can only hope that whatever trajectory the country takes after May 2024, political parties will work together to make the BIG commitment a reality. We welcome the decision to increase taxes on alcohol and cigarettes, products that harm the health of society and contribute to non-communicable diseases should not be easily accessible and must be harshly regulated to reduce the money the government spends on the harm they cause. Honourable members, we demanded more taxes on those earning over 1 million and implementing an annual wealth tax to help stop budget cuts, to help increase social grants and implement the BIG. This is unacceptable and disappointing considering that even salaried people can hardly afford to keep up with the cost of living. The rich continue to pocket more money while the poor continue to pay more for basics. Honourable members, now I move to National Treasury and their higher obligations. So in our public submission to the Finance Committee a year ago, we asked National Treasury to provide the research and evidence used to inform some of their decisions, such as, you know, not increasing taxes on the richest and not increasing social grants with adequate amounts. The committee, the Finance Committee, stated that National Treasury should provide the information, but, you know, we were ignored and we ended up resorting to a PIE application in September 2023. After submitting the application, which was supposed to take 30 days, National Treasury requested an extension to the 23rd of November 2023 because they were struggling to get the information as their focus is on the MTBPS. Upsetting enough that National Treasury could not readily provide the information they use to make decisions that impact millions of lives, we did not receive the requested information on the promised date. National Treasury only responded on 17 January 2024 with this. The information they provided was the 2023 National Budget Review and a bunch of links to pages that cannot be found. There is no evidence of research conducted by National Treasury as a government entity. This is unacceptable considering Minister Godongwana has once again made decisions that do not favor the poor. We call on this committee to discipline National Treasury and interrogate some of the decisions they make as they continue to hurt the poor majority. And finally, honourable members, as members of parliament, your role is to represent the people and hold Treasury to account. More recently, the three largest political parties have had a lot to say about social grants, but there seems to be a disconnect between their words and their actions. We look forward to hearing what each of you will do to ensure this budget does not fail the marginalized majority. We caution political parties stating they will only implement a BIG if there are favorable economic conditions. This caveat is used as an excuse to delay delay implementing a BIG. People cannot eat promises. We want plans on the date when the BIG will start, how much it will be, and how many people will receive it. We also want plans on how it will be funded. A BIG cannot be funded through cuts to social spending or increasing VAT, which we are very grateful that it was not increased in the budget. The extreme wealth in our country must be taxed to fund a BIG. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation and your recommendations. I think members have noted all the things that they want to raise so far. We will now give Budget Justice Coalition. I hope you have the hosting rights.
Whoever. Good morning. Good morning, Honorable Ms. Mahlangu. Thank you. I'm going to try to see if we do.
Yes, you do. You do say.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Can everybody see the screen?
Not yet.
Okay, one moment. And now?
It's getting there, yes.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everybody. My name is Elroy Perlis. I'm part of the Budget Justice Coalition, which I'll explain in a minute, but I'm sure some of you have heard of us and our work.
Sorry, sir, can you please go to slide mode?
Doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Is this one?
It's fine, thank you.
Thank you so much. So, honorable members, Chair, select and standing committee members. In the earlier version I sent you, I neglected to mention that. Greetings to you and thank you for the opportunity. The outline of our presentation is as follows. But as I explained, we are a coalition of 21 civic organizations that claim to collaboratively build people's understanding of and participation in South Africa's planning and budget processes. I'm pleased to say that just now you have heard at least two or three of them, and I think another one, Section 27, will be making its presentation. So for the purposes of time, brevity, and efficiency, we will make sure that we don't repeat the points that have already been made. You can see the varied list of NGO CBOs that comprises the Budget Justice Coalition. By way of introduction, I think the ongoing and adverse impact of austerity marked by budget cuts, the lack of consideration of the lived experiences and human rights of people in our country is telling. And as such, we call for participatory human rights impact assessments of spending allocations to especially public services in efforts to protect these services. And we argue that the cuts disproportionately impact marginalized communities who are already struggling and which perpetuates more inequality. And then we also call for a gender responsive budgeting and an end to austerity measures by the state. So we would see in the provincial equitable share that the division of revenue bill this year has increases of 2.6%, but when we adjust for inflation, 4.7% translates to a 6.9% real cut. And Ms. Christina Nomdu and the WCCC was at pains to explain the difference between nominal and real cuts. The constraints of the resources available to perform core functions effectively is telling. There is continued disinvestment trends in public service allocations, which can be called nothing else but blatant austerity. Call it fiscal consolidation, we call it austerity. the likely impact that the quality of provincial service delivery will worsen is a given. And therefore, we continue to call for allocations to the provinces to align with consumer price index, CPI, population growth, and the increased number of people relying on public services. Over and above that, large metros, as you know, Honorable Chair, draw people, and migration patterns also is a factor. Regards to gender responsive budgeting, we welcome the commitment to gender responsive budgeting some time ago by the state and the completion of the development of GRB guidelines and the intention to workshop these this coming financial year. We look forward to the fact that this budget, for the first iteration of a GRB budget in the country, and which would have wielded a major step in fiscal policy to redress gender inequity in our country. But sadly, we're disappointed to see the repeated postponement of enacting this GRB budget to the medium-term budget later this year. Young Black women have been reported as, quote, the face of unemployment, end quote, in the country. And just 2 years ago, 47% of African women were recorded as economically inactive compared to the much less 35.6% of men. So much of the work available to women is also precarious, and they are underpaid and work in difficult conditions. Therefore, our country's triple challenge of unemployment, poverty, and inequality is gendered. You would see in the table on the right that two examples are used: cuts in health care disproportionately impacting women, and B, that cuts to funding for basic education negatively impact women. Please read at your leisure the fact that this causes unequal disproportionate risk in HIV prevalence, that women's reproductive and maternal health services are hampered by budget cuts, that the gender-based violence causes survivors to require immediate medical attention, life-saving care, and specialized mental health and psychosocial support, that employment of over 90% of nurses in our public health system are women who struggle to make an underfunded system work on the ground. Then in terms of basic education, employment, 72.5% of state teachers are women. That in terms of ECD, the increased access is an effective way of creating new jobs in the care economy. 95% of people employed in this sector, ECD, are women. And for every woman in ECD who works, 6 to 10 women are able to take up full-time employment. So this is a critical component. The fact that gendered impact of aggressive fiscal consolidation, austerity measures, particularly budget cuts, is telling. In our country, women-led households are 40% poorer than ones led by men. Honorable Chair, I'm going to skip a couple of slides because some of these have been covered by some of our members. Let it just be noted that we continue to call for the urgent implementation of GRP on many levels through gendered outcomes, and we look forward to progress updates on this, and will participate in public consultations as these occur. Now, moving on to personnel funding the public sector wage bill, we disagree with the view that efforts to contain the public sector wage bill is in fact not, it can be perceived as ballooning or growing in an uncontrolled way. That's not the case. Rather, we believe that compensation spending has fallen in real terms for the last 4 years, that the fiscal framework presents a locked-in underfunding of the public sector wage bill, regardless of future wage agreements. And we argue that if the wage bill growth aligns with inflation from 2024, it would require headcounts to fall, permanently reducing the number of government employees. It's unclear, given the population growth, the ever-worsening poverty and inequality, how the Minister of Finance tends to provide the means to deliver services in the future when key departments are already facing staff shortages. It is known that the disproportionate impact of lower-income earners, Black women and children especially, disproportionately rely and therefore suffer on these essential public services. Noting that women are overly represented in the public sector jobs, approximately 62%, if these cuts happen, and we see that happening already, this limits the ability to secure paid, decent employment, further impoverishing them. Now, on conditional grants. We see that the allocations on conditional grants to the provinces increased from last year's 121.3 to 129. That's a 6.3% increase, which is above the 4.7% CPI for the period. This is noteworthy and heartening. While we welcome these increases to conditional grants, since they fund essential programs like school nutrition, infrastructure, HIV/AIDS treatment, education, it means that provinces are better equipped to realize the rights to education and access to healthcare for all. We will explore the conditional grants in greater detail in the education and health sectors, but overall, we welcome the reversal of cost containment measures in this regard. So when we come to the EIG, the Education Infrastructure Grant, and the HIV and AIDS Life Skills Education, the EIG is still below the 2023-24 allocation before the cost containment measures. We welcome the inflation link increases to the National School Nutrition Program and the District Health Programs Grant, but we critique the nominal cuts to the Health Infrastructure and School Infrastructure Backlog Grant, and that the real cuts to the learners will have profound impact, especially on those who are intellectually disabled. The budget cuts to underperforming programs without actual investment to fight underspending means that the marginalized learners who most rely on these programs and interventions will be further disenfranchised. Honorable Chairperson and members, similar to the provincial equitable share, adequately funding education and health conditional grants is a chance to advance gender responsive budgeting, thereby redressing gender inequity and lessening the burdens of socioeconomic challenges the most marginalized being women. And the National Treasury continues to propose budgets that disinvest in basic education. The increase nominal of 3 to 4.5 billion, but a real decrease when factoring in inflation and increased learner enrollment. We believe this will hamper progress towards equitable access to quality basic education as enshrined by law and further entrench inequality both within and beyond the education system. On ECD, here we refer to the period from conception to 5 years of age. In order for children to thrive, there must be equitable access to 5 components of ECD: care and early learning, nutrition, social protection, maternal and child health, and support for caregivers. Investment in these services are necessary to reduce child poverty, improve school readiness, tackle gender inequality, and provide a cost-effective route to job creation in township and rural economies, enabling long-term human capital formation and economic growth. We would see, sadly, that the positive steps mentioned earlier are tempered by a freezing of the ECD subsidy value at 17 Rand per child per day for the 6th consecutive year, Honorable Chair. This will place almost 11,500 ECD programs that rely on these subsidies as their main source of income under further pressure as food, electricity, and other costs continue to increase. The current setting of 17 Rand for ECD centers and 6 Rand for non-center-based programs, the value of the subsidy has been reduced effectively since 2019 by 25%. So we will see that this pegging, the graphic example of how many eggs it could buy between 2019 and 2024 has decreased more than double. And for learners lucky enough to benefit from state ECD subsidies, less than half of eligible children, in reality, it shows that meals provided by ECD institutions can sometimes be their main and most stable source of nutrition. Hence, the impact of these cuts are dire. 27% of children under 5 are stunted, concerning lack of adequate nutritional support is therefore very worrisome. We welcome the 197 million allocation to DBE for an early nutrition pilot, and we hope that the provinces are intimately involved in the planning, design, execution, and evaluation of these pilots in conjunction with the ECD sector itself. I'm going to move on for the purposes of time, Honorable Chair, but noting that the current budget reversed the cut in access to ECD, and given the historic neglect of the ECD sector and at least 50,000 informal ECD operators, it is clear that more support will be needed and need to be provided over the medium term. This graph on the right shows that over time between 2015 and projected for the year after next, there is inadequacy to empower provincial education departments in meeting their responsibilities to provide and maintain safe and appropriate infrastructure at public schools. We advocate for the urgent intervention in overcoming underspending in education programs, pronounced as 800 schools unfortunately still using pit latrines. This requires urgent intervention. Again, the respective provincial allocations of the EIG remains largely stable over the MTEF, but we do note over here that there has been a significant decrease in the Gauteng province, and we are concerned about it. We caution that there's severe overcrowding crisis at the public ordinary schools, as highlighted by media reports from numerous unplaced learners after 7 weeks into the academic program. I'm going to skip this one. Climate change. The DBE estimates it will cost $12.2 billion to fix schools made entirely of inappropriate materials. 10.2 of this to provide sustainable water sources to schools, 235 million to provide toilets to schools where there are none. And again, very problematically, the infrastructure base, grant has been reduced by 1.526 billion over the MTEF. So at the current level of 1.64 billion, it's already too low to correct even the most urgent infrastructure backlogs. Proposed cuts should be reversed. Additional allocations should be made to the grant so that the backlogs can be eradicated. And we do note that what will hit all of us is the worsening climate crisis, and that we need to build classrooms made with climate-resilient materials, and it also extends to water and sanitation projects, as climate change will affect water security and quality at schools as well. We urge Parliament to consider the Financial and Fiscal Commission's recommendation that the Treasury and departments consider indirect grants like the SIBG only as the last resort measure, while continuing to build capacity in provinces and municipalities, a position supported by the Treasury. However, reducing this SIBG grant, budget without investing in capacity building and fighting underspending will likely only entrench the barrier that infrastructure plays in the education attainment of under-resourced schools. Then to the Fundza Lushaka bursary scheme. Be suspicious. I learned that term means. Research shows that 48% of publicly paid teachers are expected to retire and exit the teaching profession in a very short period of time. In 6 years from now, there will be a massive teacher shortage crisis. 398 billion will be cut from this bursary scheme, which promotes teaching as a career. The decision to prioritize the postgraduate certificates in education, therefore, is confusing, because due to cost containment measures implemented by the Treasury last year, the Department of Basic Education was forced to withdraw already awarded bursaries from all PGCE students who were 2 months into the academic year. Very worrisome. We note that waterborne bacteria causes infections that thrive in water, warmer temperatures. Pit latrines are not only unsafe, but inadequate in this context. we urge Parliament to consider the FFC's recommendation again. On district health programs and HIV and AIDS funding, we reiterate points made in the section or the coming section 27 submission. We are alarmed to see that the 2024-5 budget has a proposed 1.3 billion cut to the comprehensive HIV/AIDS component of the district health programs per year over the MTEF period. Furthermore, Honourable Chair, we worried about the fact that the reasons for these cuts are motivated as are known to be due to underspending and uptake of ART treatment is running significantly below target. This was mentioned earlier by one of our members. We raised about concern about the underspending of this grant, notably for the 2022-23 fiscal year, and that the Gauteng Health Department underspent 1.6 billion of its district health services budget, which includes HIV AIDS treatment services. And we find the response to underspending budget cuts to be inappropriate and overlooking human rights and the lived experience. We are concerned that the lower uptake of ART may be attributed to poor health-seeking behavior among men, the unequal gender relations in our society, resulting in girls and young women in the country, particularly those in rural and underserved communities, bearing the greatest HIV risk and burden. So the decision to cut HIV funding overlooks crucial gender considerations and may worsen the inequality in our country. At the current level, 1,300 girls and women between the ages of 15 and 24 are newly infected with HIV every week. There are other grants that we're concerned about. Again, cuts are concerning, the healthcare conditional grant, including the health facility revitalization grant, which has already been characterized by massive infrastructure backlogs. The fiscal policy has the power to alleviate this, and the Division of Revenue Board proposed nominal cuts to this grant of 1.2 billion per year over the medium term. Worse, this cut follows last year's cost containment measures, which cut this funding by 5.2%. So we reiterate that government, including the Treasury, has a duty to provide proper oversight and ensure transparent, cost-effective, and accountable public procurement. Intervening by reducing the quantum of spend only reflects a failure by the state to provide proper oversight and ensure transparent, cost-effective, and accountable public procurement. On water, it's a complex matter. It involves national through the Department of Water and Sanitation, provincial offices of the department, water boards, municipalities, and all have an important role to play. So budgetary considerations are possibly even more complex. The challenges at the municipal level, particularly with municipal finances, have a profound impact on whether people can access water or not, despite this being a Section 27 right. Honorable Chair and members, the greatest proportion of municipal revenue comes from municipalities raising this money as opposed to from the national fiscus through the equitable share transfers. In turn, the greatest extent of that comes from municipalities billing for services in the form of charges for water, electricity, and rates. Many of us know that the supply of water and electricity are both constrained. Water is constrained due to drought and because of leaks, often due to poor management of infrastructure, where municipalities are spending less than the recommended 8% of the value of assets on repairs and maintenance. In fact, in some places, and as per the Auditor General's MFMA report of 2021-2022, they claim that municipalities also struggle to maintain their infrastructure assets as they only spend an average of 1% of the value of these assets on repairs and maintenance, far below the norm of 8%. So the effect of the supply being constrained impact on municipal revenue. The indication is that this model is coming under pressure, and the Budget Justice Coalition has highlighted this numerous times previously. So the proportion of the budget that municipality gets from the national fiscus is a clear indication that leaving it to the discretion of municipalities to spend the money according to their prioritization is resulting in misplaced priorities. We know, Honorable Chair, of the high unemployment levels, many households not being able to pay, by not having a stipulation that the equitable share allocations for free basic water should be spent on water, for example, indigent residents are being shortchanged. Several municipalities, for example, are proceeding arguably the wrong priorities. For example, not paying their water boards while spending on new offices when people don't have water and there are leaks. We recognize that municipalities have an equal footing as the other spheres of government per the Constitution, but these funds are not being ring-fenced, meaning they can be and are spent on other expenses. The table below demonstrates how the impact is disproportionate amongst the metros, with the most populous city, the city of Johannesburg, showing that almost 1 million households are not benefiting from this local government equitable share formula, and that the values are astronomical. I'm going to move on. One of the things that happens, especially at the local government level, is that these municipal billing issues, such as excessively high, unprovable estimates, breaks the trust of residents. So we recommend that the estimates on these bills...
I hope you're moving towards the conclusion.
I am. Thank you. We recommend that the estimates on these bills be tied to average actual use by the household to avoid the municipalities from overinflating how much money is due to them when those customers have declared a dispute to being billed an incorrect high estimated amount. And therefore, we recommend a municipal billing drive to deal with billing errors. One of the issues I will not have the time to go through, Honorable Chair, are on child support grants, but the submission is detailed, as well as the impact of youth unemployment, unfortunately. Let me conclude then in the last two slides on the importance of the Public Procurement Bill, that we made a submission to Parliament on the Public Procurement Bill, and we noted that it was a positive step, that there was room for improvement, that it closes, it must close legislative gaps, that the powers of the Public Procurement Office and the Minister of Finance indicate what the risks are, and we advocate for division of responsibilities. There must be institutional safeguards. Multiple aims are important. Transparency must be there, and it's a strategic imperative. So we advocate for careful consideration to ensure the bill mitigates the risks. There's a strengthening of the frameworks, but that unfettered ministerial powers, transparency and accountability mechanisms must be addressed in the current version of the Public Procurement Bill before the NCOP. So there, in a nutshell, are our recommendations, and we thank you for the opportunity to do so. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Budget Justice Coalition. Section 27, over to you. Hope you have the hosting rights.
Hi, I believe I do. Let me, can everyone see my slides?
Yes, you can see.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let me start. Okay, so thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. Good morning to everyone who's in attendance. So my name is Matsidiso Lengwasa, and I'll be doing Section 27's presentation to this committee. So Section 27 is a public interest law center. So we focus on the right to basic education and the right to access quality healthcare services. And as such, our presentation will be focused on that. We also form part of the Budget Justice Coalition. So some of the things that we were presenting have been touched on in that presentation. So I guess that'll save me some time. So I'll just start with the context that we find ourselves in as a country. So we know that we continue to weather harsh economic climates in this country, and it is the most marginalized people in our society, unfortunately, who bear this burden. So there have been reports of malnutrition, of increasing rates of poverty. There's been unemployment that has remained high, as we all know that there are qualified doctors, teachers, and nurses who are still sitting at home and are not absorbed into the staffing the public health and basic education systems. But at the same time, those systems are heavily understaffed. And so with all of this context in mind, we know that we need policy and legislation and funding that can alleviate the suffering that is experienced by people in this country. However, even though the Division of Revenue Bill this year is less austere than last year's cost containment measures, it is still an austere budget that will probably constrain the resources that are available for schools and clinics and hospitals to provide quality healthcare and education services. We need to reiterate that even in weak economic climates, the constitutional rights to, well, basic education and access to healthcare services are constitutionally protected rights, and as such, they must continue to be provisioned for even in this context. And so this presentation really seeks to propose some recommendations that can advance the power of the Division of Revenue Bill to protect these constitutional rights. So one of the most powerful ways to do so is gender-responsive budgeting. So I believe most of this was covered in the BJC submission, so I'll just slide through this, is that really we were looking forward to this year's budget and this year's Division of Revenue Bill because it would have been the first iteration of gender-responsive budgeting, a gender-responsive budget in our country. And we know we need this because the triple challenge that we face in our country of inequality, unemployment, and poverty are actually racialized and there's feminization of that phenomena. Women-led households are poorer. Unemployment statistics, Black women are more represented in those. And then we know that in gender-based inequality has manifested as gender-based violence and femicide that continues to plague our country, unfortunately. And a gender-responsive budget would be a powerful way in redressing the gender inequalities in our country. Unfortunately, this has been pushed later to the MTBPS this year, which we're disappointed in because it means that another budget has been passed without the adequate consideration of the impact on gender equity in this country. So we reiterate a call for urgent implementation of gender-responsive budgeting to alleviate this, as well as recommending public workshopping of gender-responsive budgets, guidelines, and tagging to better wield the Division of Revenue Bill to redress gender inequities in the country. We also call on Parliament, National Treasury, and all stakeholders, everyone in attendance, to apply a gendered lens to decisions when it comes to the public sector wage bill. As we know, most nurses in this country are women. Over 90% of nurses in the public sector are women. Over 70% of teachers are women. And 80% of people who are employed in the public sector are Black women. So when we talk about containing the public sector wage bill, we need to remember that it has implications for gender and racial relations in this country. And it has implications in that way. And then also, that when it comes to unpaid care work, the burden is disproportionately racialized and gendered. And so as such, the reliance or the impact of budget cuts is disproportionately borne by women in this country. And a gender-responsive budget would be a powerful way to alleviate this. So moving on to the provincial equitable share. So the provincial equitable share has received a below inflation increase of 2.6%, meaning that there is a limit of available resources to perform core functions effectively in the province, including the provision of education and healthcare services. We recommend reversing this trend of disinvesting in the provincial equitable share and also to consider the growing number of public service users so that the value of the PES is not eroded. Moving back to personnel funding challenges, which I touched on a bit when reflecting on gender-responsive budgeting, we know in our country that there have been protests from newly qualified doctors who have not been able to find work. We know that there are about over 20,000 teachers who have tertiary qualification, who are tertiary qualified in education, who are unemployed. And we know that we have unemployed nurses, many unemployed nurses in the country. And this is more alarming when you consider that our public health and education systems, our public systems, are deeply understaffed. And this deep understaffing is attributed directly to budget constraints. But this year's Division of Revenue Bill and budget speech are unlikely to alleviate this, because basic education, the wage bill for basic education has received a 2.2% real cut. So after accounting for inflation, meaning that it's unlikely that the number of teachers will be, the teacher headcount is going to be increased. Likely it will probably decrease. Even National Treasury has acknowledged that these budget allocations threaten education outcomes, overcrowding, larger class sizes, and higher teacher-learner ratios. We're also seeing some of the lowest replacement rates of retiring teachers because of this fiscal austerity, and we've seen a budget cut that has been proposed to the Funza Lushaka Bursary, which Equal Education has spoken about extensively, and the impact of that on quality education provision in this country. This extends also to healthcare, where there's also been a real cut to the public health wage bill. It's likely, again, that staff headcounts will continue to decrease this year. There'll be vacant posts will remain unfilled because of budget constraints. And we need to caution that it's the overworked staff who are faced with covering the impacts of austere budgets. There have been many reports of nurses using their own funds to fill the gap and they're already underpaid, and to fill the gap that is left by underfunded healthcare system. Okay, I've already spoken about the health and the gender implications of the personnel wage bill, so I'll move on to healthcare conditional grants. So just want to say, on the surface, healthcare, well, when you dig into it, healthcare has only received an increase of 1.7%, which is below the 4.7% inflation, which means there's a real cut and an erosion to how the investments in healthcare services. This is more pronounced in the health facility revitalization grant, which actually funds infrastructure backlogs, just infrastructure projects in healthcare in general. We're alarmed to see further budget cuts towards it in nominal terms. So that's even before accounting for inflation. So there's 1.2 billion per year that has been approved. However, we still have massive infrastructure backlogs in this country. And this grant specifically has been plagued by underspending. And we are in agreement that underspending is a serious problem, chronic and historical underspending, because it actually undermines the rights to quality, to access quality healthcare services. However, responding to underspending by cutting the budget doesn't actually address the chronic and historical underspending. Instead, it just punishes the healthcare user with poor quality services and less money to, or less resources available to give them quality healthcare. And so we recommend urgent investments in capacity building and other interventions, including consequence management for underperforming implementing agents, among other things, just thinking beyond budget cuts, because they don't actually solve this problem. Looking at mental health services, so South Africa is ranked low in the World Mental Health Report, and this has been attributed to high levels of violence, poverty, unemployment, and inequality. And in fact, the Deputy President, Paul Mashatile, actually wrote an op-ed in the Mail and Guardian last year reflecting on this and calling for, we need to do better as a country regarding mental health services. However, the Division of Revenue Bill allocation is unlikely to do that, because there's been a cut to, a proposed cut. So firstly, mental health services have been eroded, are being eroded, the value's been eroded by inflation. So in real terms, there's a cut to that. And then in nominal terms, Contracting mental health practitioners in the public sector has received a nominal cut of 8%, and it doesn't reflect any urgency to address mental health crisis in the country. So regarding HIV funding, we're alarmed to see further proposals of budget cuts, nominal cuts to HIV funding. So 1.3 billion has been proposed. And we are also alarmed to see that there's been an acceptance that there's been a lower uptake last year, and that as a justification for the budget cuts. This is concerning because unlike our neighbors and other countries like Rwanda and Tanzania, South Africa has not achieved the 95-95-95 targets, right? So we still have, we're still struggling to ensure that people who are on antiretroviral treatment, there's retention of people on antiretroviral treatment. And so we recommend, we welcome that there have been cost savings from being able to procure antiretroviral treatment for cheaper for our country. However, we recommend using this funding, instead of returning it to Treasury, we need to scale up our ART coverage so that people with HIV can live fuller lives and overcome this epidemic, and to also improve treatments and literacy and comprehensive support to bolster ART retention. So moving on to basic education. So basic education, although it has received historically larger investment compared to other areas, except recently with debt servicing costs, we still have many schools that are deeply underfunded. There's still unsafe pit latrines, and there's still teacher shortages and overcrowding in the country. However, the allocation to basic education and the conditional grants are unlikely to alleviate that because they will be eroded by inflation as they are below inflation increases, meaning there are fewer resources to provide quality basic education. We see this in the education infrastructure grant, which while it receives an 11.4% increase on the surface, that looks great. However, last year during the cost containment measures, there was a cut of 11.5%, which means all we're seeing is a reversal of that cut. And then there are further cuts that are proposed, so 611 million rand over the medium term. This does not support the government's call to urgently eradicate unsafe pit latrines because it will result in delayed project implementation, or there's encouraging of that. However, we need to urgently eradicate pit latrines and also eradicate, we need to overcome overcrowding. This extends to the school infrastructure backlog grant, which also has a 1.2 billion cut. And so we recognize that this is one grant that has low spending rates. However, if we cut this budget without any alternative forms of intervention to address the infrastructure backlogs, it just perpetuates those backlogs because, you know, it doesn't actually solve the problem. And so we critique that, and we're concerned about the impact that will have on the realization of education rights. So I'm nearly running out of time. So for school nutrition, just want to say that I will reiterate what Equal Education has said, that while we welcome the 5.6% increase that's tied to food inflation, we caution that food inflation tends to be higher than what National Treasury has projected. And also to recommend or to extend the Human Rights Commission's recommendations to extend the school nutrition program to below primary school level and to weekends and holidays, because it is the only nutritious meal for millions of learners, or many learners in this country. We also welcome the HIV/AIDS Life Skills Grant increased allocation and the reversal of the cut, because there has been a public warning on risky behavior that increases transmission of STIs and HIV infection. UNAIDS has found that providing sexual education is a significant way in overcoming this risky behavior. So we welcome this. So in conclusion, we just call on the Division of Revenue Bill to foreground human rights, especially at a time like this, where people are going through economic hardship in our country. And we can do this by implementing participatory human rights impact assessments, gender-responsive budgeting, and urgently addressing underspending. And we just want to remind Cabinet as we close that the UN had expressed concern about the austerity measures and the impact that would have on our fiscal policy and the redistributive capacity. And we call on members of this cabinet and this of parliament and this committee to heed that call. Thank you very much. I'll stop sharing now.
Thank you, Comrade Matthew Kosatu. Yes. Your time now.
Right. Morning, Chair. And yeah, thanks to members for giving us space just to share our presentation. Okay, we're co-host now. Let me just quickly upload it quickly, Chair. So, Chair, we would cover both the Division of Revenue Bill as well as the Second Adjustments Appropriation Bill. And I'm sure we can stick to the time frame definitely. So I think just say thanks for giving us space as always, Cassandra, just to share our views with the honourable members. We had really, when we look at the budget in February, in the run-up, we really hoped the government would table quite a bold and decisive and progressive budget as well as a DOR bill. We do feel that it really wasn't that. There's a bit of a mixed budget. We'd hoped to see more that will really stimulate the economy, provide relief to the poor, rebuild the state. At the end of the day, we've got a bit of a mixed budget. There are some positive allocations and interventions which we do want to acknowledge, but also there's some quite worrying below CPI cuts to many provinces and to municipalities which are penciled in over the MTEF period. And I think, Chair, from a fiscal framework stance, we don't think we're going to get out of a crisis if we continue to stumble along a 1.3-1.8% GDP growth rate. And I think where we differ from Treasury is that we think Treasury feels largely that our crisis is a debt issue. But in fact, the debt issue is a symptom of our crisis, not a cause of the crisis. Our crisis really is caused by slow economic growth rates, the very high levels of unemployment, the high levels of crime and corruption, the difficult period we've gone through with load shedding, but we do recognize we've made significant progress on that front over the past year. And that must be applauded and maintained. The real issues of cable theft, coupling, transit freight rail, the port congestion, some of our dysfunctional municipalities, especially in the Free State, Northwest and Eastern Cape provinces. And of course, our stubborn levels of poverty and inequality and just a bit of a general sense of despair among society. We were quite surprised, Chair, that in the run-up to the MTPS September last year, the Treasury moved to freeze vacancies and infrastructure investments, which we felt were going to really hamper public service delivery capacity and, of course, also choke the economy, which does need to be stimulated. So we appreciate the fiscal constraints facing the state and the need to cut fat, to reprioritize expenditure, but if we think at times if we simply take this blunt expenditure cut of Treasury, we're not going to do that. We're going to choke the economy, we're going to weaken the public services and municipal services. Fundamentally, what we do think we need, Chair, is a sustainable path to grow the economy. That's the only way if we want to actually reduce the debt trajectory. And Chair, look, we do appreciate under the DOR that there is a need to adjust allocation at times to deal with unexpected issues, to deal with under-expenditure or new priorities. And a large part of it would be around catering for the wage agreement. And we know that it's always a popular sport among some politicians to blame public servants for wanting to earn a living wage, but we think there's nothing wrong with nurses wanting to see their salaries being protected from being eroded by inflation to stay out of debt, et cetera. So we do think there is efforts, we need to continue to maintain them to rebuild collective bargaining in the state, to move back towards multi-year agreements. And this is also going to help make it easier for government to plan the budget and, of course, to avoid having to make changes afterwards when wage agreements come into effect. So on some of the specific purpose allocations to provinces, we think there's some positive ones in terms of agriculture, where there's very significant increases to emerging farmers under the Letsema program. That's something quite positive. We really want to see that being enhanced. There's some good work being done around basic education in terms of the significant investments around early childhood development, and that's going to become critical when the Bella Bill is hopefully passed by Parliament before elections, which will then formalize a grade R as part of the formal school curriculum and make it required. And there is some good allocations, large allocations for this current financial year on the infrastructure grant for schools. We really hope that it's going to be implemented and we don't have this continual shifting of posts around the school infrastructure crisis. But a quite dismayed Chair that under DBE, under the MTEF, so they're planning to end the presidential promise stimulus, which has hired teaching assistants. I think it's about 340,000, if I'm right. So I could be wrong about my numbers, but nonetheless, we think that we shouldn't be ending that program. We should be actually extending it and enhancing it. There's a bit of a worrying, almost a 60% cut in the allocations under human settlements for formal settlement upgrades. We see some shift to local government in that regard. We hope that's not going to have an overall impact upon it. But it's also quite worrying that line item, that 45% wasn't spent in the 2022-23 budget year. That's quite alarming. Chair, just some two issues on the Treasury. Was again under the presidential promise stimulus that planned to end and under the MTEF, the Neighborhood Development Partnership Grant, which has been quite useful in cleaning up townships and providing about 22,000 work opportunities. Again, we should be extending this program when we have an unemployment rate of 41%. And we do want to support the significant increase in funding for the rolling out of smart electricity meters, because that's critical in terms of ensuring ESCOM itself can be stabilized and can have the necessary revenue to address the load shedding crisis, et cetera. Chair, just with regards to local government, I think we all know the horror pictures from the Auditor General's reports, where about 90%, give or take, are experiencing some degree of financial distress. I think we have seen a bit of improvement where, about a year ago, 2 years ago, it was about 36 municipalities struggling to pay staff. When we did our latest audit on that issue, it's about 22 municipalities. So that's some progress. It's still a crisis, but at least we hope there's some movement in that direction. And of course, we should be worried about, municipal money owed to municipalities, quite staggering at 280 billion rand. Of course, money owed by municipalities to ESCOM, very high at 57 and 60 billion rand. And of course, this has an impact upon the ability of municipalities to provide basic services, indigent grants, and subsidies. We think many municipalities have actually quietly chosen to abandon that. That needs to be investigated. But we've seen as a consequence of collapse of basic services in some towns in the Northwest and the Free State, companies are closing, workers are being retrenched. So we do remain very concerned that local government is the weakest link, especially with regards to corruption. But we're not really seeing a roadmap to move us towards the district development model. There might be some indication of the DOR bill that we think is hinting at that, and that can be positive, but we don't really see an overall clear plan from the COGTA. But having said that, we do want to welcome the increased municipal grants, especially the intervention and capacity building programs for about 140 municipalities. So we hope that is going to make a significant difference. There's a really positive, huge infrastructure program over the MTEF period of about 943 billion rand, half of which would go into SOEs, about a quarter would go into municipalities. So that is going to necessitate the recapacitation of local governments of SOEs. We do think, Chair, that given the level of challenges experienced at local government level, that it's even more critical than ever before for Parliament also to increase its oversight role, especially at the NCP, over the performance of local government around the infrastructure program, et cetera. Chair, just in terms of the municipalities which are struggling to pay staff continuously, whether it's the salaries, whether it's the third-party deductions, or it's the issue of adjustments, et cetera, yes, it's 22, that's better than before, but I think there's some worrying continuous parties in that regard. In the Eastern Cape, we've seen it's less than before, but it's still usual suspects at Dalinjebo, Port St. John's, Enoch Mkichima, Joe Kabi, Amatoli District. In the Free State, which really is the epicenter of municipal chaos, again, the usual suspects, Kopanong, Masilo Yane, Mafube, Mohokari, Toholoho, Maluti, and really, I think right now the epicenter is Machabeng, which we fear is on the verge of collapse. I think in Northern Cape, we've seen an improvement. It's much less than before, with about two. Northwest, it remains, again, competing with Free States, with about six or so municipalities. Slightly less than before, but some really are extreme ICU, like the Tabotla. Limpopo is slightly different. The issue there is that some of these municipalities were merged together and they had different grading systems. So now the challenge is that if you came from one municipality, you might be paid at a lower rate than somebody came from a different municipality. Yet you are now working together, you're driving the same tractors, et cetera, but you get paid a different salary. And as we've seen in Etiquini, if those issues are not resolved, they can explode. Chair, on municipal equitable share, we do want to appreciate positive above CPI increases, some quite good ones for Buffalo City, for Nelson Mandela Bay, for Mangaung. We hope that can make a difference. In Mpumalanga, across municipalities, there were significant investments, and also in Gao municipalities in the Northern Cape. But again, Chair, there's below cuts over MTF period, Eastern Cape, and when one looks at the Eastern Cape municipalities, it tends to be those like Amatole, Jokabi, which are in real trouble, struggling to pay staff, struggling to provide basic services. Quite a few in rural parts of KZN, which also is a bit worrying. And in Limpopo, almost all of them, which is, again, quite worrying. But around the MIG, the Municipal Infrastructure Grants Chair, I think there is good increases above MTEF for quite a few municipalities, like Harib, across Gauteng, and a couple in KZN and Limpopo, and the Northern Cape and Northwest. Others largely in line with inflation, but there were some below inflation cuts, which we're a bit worried about for Fadili Dabi, which has been one of those weak municipalities. And some significant cuts we felt were a bit concerning for the Wildlands and Overberg District, Overberg municipalities in the Western Cape. And the Wildlands really is a significant population economic growth center. That's your Worcester, your Paarl, Stellenbosch areas. Chair, then just in terms of the second adjustment appropriation bill, just quickly, we're concerned about some of the cuts. So we're shifting 400 million rand away from the CWP, yet we have an unemployment crisis, we have a municipal service crisis. We're giving 80 million rand for DERCO, for public diplomacy and protocol. We're not sure if that really is a priority. Yet the center, we felt that actually if we had that kind of money available, we should have given it to the CCMA, which is really battling to cope with a surge of increases filed by workers for protection from abuses. We do want to support the Home Affairs additional 200 million rand for political parties. We think political parties are an essential component of a constitutional democracy. We should give them support to reach voters. And of course, we want to protect political parties from entrepreneurs who would want to extol favors from them. So if the state can give support to parties, it helps to insulate our political system from corruption. And there is positive allocations under the justice cluster for courts, for NPA, for the Chief Justice. And, you know, this is a positive. We hope it has some impact upon capacity of the NPA to prosecute corruption cases, et cetera. But we feel this is not enough, given the levels of crime and corruption we're really battling to overcome. I think just getting lastly that we do think there's a need to overhaul some of our dysfunctional municipalities. We need to have a roadmap towards a district development model. We should really be hoping to expand the presidential promise stimulus to accommodate at least 2 million participants. This is key to helping young people earn a salary, but also to gain the skills and experience to enter the labor market. And we should really be making sure we expedite implementation of the infrastructure programs. So I think in conclusion, Chair, we think the government does show the necessary fortitude and vision. We can, with some common sense interventions, we can grow the economy to 4%, in particular if we can deal with the network obstacles like ESCOM and transit and so forth. These are the ways to make sure the economy grows and we reduce unemployment, we rebuild the state, and that alone, Chair, is going to put the fiscus on a sustainable path. But we need to see government moving much greater speed. We should not simply be treating the budget as an accounting exercise. But I think, Chair, you know, COSATU will continue to engage with government on these issues. We want government to succeed, because ultimately if government succeeds, workers will benefit. But yeah, let me stop there, Chair. Hopefully I stuck to the time frame. Thanks, Chair members.
Thank you very much, Comrade Matthew. Now is the time for members to engage with all the presentations. I hope you have noted the areas where you want to get clarity or comment, but I still emphasize, please, members, to be stretched to your questions. Very good presentations, and I'm really impressed by the number of people who showed an interest in this bill. It's very important, and it's good that also the majority of women and young people participating in it. Secretariat, will you assist me in identifying the hands of the members?
Sunny.
I see one. The other one is who?
Honorable Mletsane.
Yeah, I see Honorable Mletsane.
Okay.
Who else? Okay,
Honorable Karim.
Honorable Okamp. And who? Okay, Ntate Mletsane, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. And my humble apology, please. I'm experiencing the load shedding where I am here. It's a very rural place, so I'm struggling with the network. My first clarity of question will go to the rural health, and maybe other presenters, if they want to respond to it, they are welcome. The extra budget was availed now recently to Department of Health in order to address the issue of unemployed doctors. Rural health, do you think that the intervention has addressed this matter in totality? Secondly, what should be done to address this challenge? If you think that it is not addressed in totality, then what should be done to address this challenge to make sure that all qualified medical doctors are employed? Because in this country, our hospitals are really experiencing a serious shortage of medical doctors. My second and last one, Chairperson, it goes to Hosatu. I'm happy when the presenter mentioned that mentioned the word culprits. In Free State, municipalities like Kopanong, Masilonyane, Mafube, Mohokare, and Tokoloho and Machabe. Those municipalities, they are really culprits. Now, I just want to find out from COSATU, having realized that they are the culprits in terms of failing to pay workers what is due to them, is there any intervention as COSATU that you have done to resolve this bad habit? If there is any intervention that you did, what did you do? And do you see it really succeeding in order to resolve this matter? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, I think the better way for me to summarize what you have said, Honorable Mletsane, that behavior is a gross misconduct. And I think Comrade Matthew understand when we speak about gross misconduct. We can't just leave it as is. Honorable Okamp can come in.
Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you very much. Chairperson, yes, firstly, thank you to all the presenters. We received a lot of information today, and it's good to see that the public are participating in this and they are driving the issues that they really care about. I want to thank all the presenters here today. As I said, we've received a lot of information, and we are thankful for that. Chairperson, I'm going to start with COSATU. We share in a lot of instances the same sentiments when it comes to our worries with regards to the growth rate and that we know that we won't get out of the situation that we are if we do not increase that. And I want to thank Sartre for always putting out the failure of local government. We all know that that is where service delivery really takes place. That is where the people on ground level really feel it to their skins. And if you've got 90% of your municipalities in a country that is in financial distress, we will feel the brunt, and the people on ground level will feel what's going on there. The point that I want to make with regards to that, and this is my question to COSATU, we see these municipalities that's got huge problems. And we hear the political ideology of cadre deployment being defended. But our beliefs are that we've got the problems that we experience on local government level, especially due to cadre deployment, which opens up the door for corruption to creep in. And corruption is definitely one of the biggest enemies that we've got. What is Kusatu's viewpoint of cadre deployment in especially local government, and what could be done to stop that and rather get fit for purpose people that are employed there? With regards to Kusatu as well, I would like to ask, what do they think could have been done differently by National Treasury to come up with a bold and decisive and progressive budget, as well as division of reasonable? And could Kusatu outline specific steps that can be followed by Treasury to address future budget steps? Also, we are talking every year about the size of our public service, and I know that Kusatu will defend that size every year. But I would like to find out from Kusatu, with our population growth, what do they think would be the correct size or ratio of the public service in South Africa to have a balance between public servants and the population, but also to ensure that service delivery is provided by those public services members. And it doesn't help us to year on year give increases. We know that people should get increases, and we know that there are public servants such as our policemen and teachers and nurses and doctors that really work hard and need to get those increases. But what is, according to Kusatu, the correct ratio that they think should apply? Then, according to Kusatu, what specific steps should be taken to turn around the situation at Transnet without pumping in more government bailouts? What do they think should happen there? Because we are obviously facing a huge crisis with regards to that. Chairperson, then with regards to the Rural Health Advocacy Project, the findings of the research to assess progress in achieving the health coverage in rural districts has been presented to the relevant government authorities. What do they think? How effective did the district health program have been? How effective has the district health program been in addressing some of the rural health system challenges? And what specific steps should be taken by government to ensure that rural communities have adequate access to quality health services and that there are resources allocated to further address universal access to health care for those people? We know that our people in our rural areas often have to travel vast distances to get to clinics. They arrive there, there are no nurses sometimes, there are no medicine available for them. What do they think should happen to improve that? Chairperson, and just one last thing, just check my notes. Yeah, what is also very worrying back to Kusatu is the whole issue about human settlements. The fact that we had a 45% of the funding in the 22-23 year that was not spent correctly. That means that there's almost half of the budget that could have gone to the upliftment of human settlements in those informal areas that could have received services, but they did not. And we've now this year got large cuts for informal settlements. What do they think should be done in order to turn that around so that we can deliver services to those people in those informal settlements where it is really, really desperately needed? Thank you, Chairperson. That's all from my side.
Thank you very much, Honorable Oka. Very passionate, Mhlahlandlela ubambile, in as far as cadre deployment is concerned. I know whenever you speak, you'll speak about cadre deployment. We are very passionate about that thing. I'll now hand over to, or before I hand over to Honorable Karim, I think it's also something that we all need to come to an understanding and not look at the color of the colors of the government of the day, but think more of the community or the citizens. When you we speak about the qualified medical doctors, qualified teachers, engineers who are unemployed, and we say we need more teachers, we need more police, we need more health professionals. It is something that we cannot dispute because those departments or those institutions are personnel dependent. If we don't have more teachers, then we will not have the relevant or the correct ratio in as far as teacher learner is concerned. And I also liked what you said about some of the police, not all of the police, but some of the police, and I'm talking from experience, my recent experience. I had experience. I will hand over to Comrade Yunis.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Firstly, I'm not sure how to say this, Comrade Chair, but there's a sense in which one feels overwhelmed by the submissions. As you said, they're very good. But also, I don't know how to say this, you know, Chairperson, because people can choose to misinterpret what I say if it suits them. But what does one do? I can't summon to my aid right now the correct words. But I also feel a sense of not powerless, frustration that now people will say, hey, don't tell us all that. You are the ultimate decision makers, not the executive, not us in civil society. But we are operating under severe constraints, most of which I think we increasingly admit are self-inflicted. We can look at the global context, but ultimately that doesn't explain many of our failures. And it's good that we're being more open about it. But the point I want to make is, who can disagree, Chairperson? Which member here is going to disagree with the overwhelming number of requests or demands made to us? That's not the issue. The issue is, as our friends from civil society also say, as do we, it's about the powerless state of the economy, poor economic growth, failures in the state, and a variety of things I don't need to cover. I think there's reasonable consensus on what the issues are, even if there's no agreement on how we tackle them. So really, I just want to say we agree with the basic thrust of what people are saying. But there are these constraints that we need to take more careful account of. You see, ideally, Chairperson, I don't know what we do. You see, they come here every year saying the same things, and we really value them coming because it must be immensely frustrating for them. But they must understand it's also frustrating for us, because as much as we have the will, they don't accept it. But we have far more will and commitment than I think civil society makes out. There are these constraints, and those of us who actually deal with the rands and cents know perhaps more than others, not all others in civil society, what the difficulties are, because we deal with it daily. So, ideally what we should think about, Chairperson, in our legacy report, maybe the two appropriations committee chairs should call us together. What is it we can do to ensure the system of exchange is not like a constant cycle of repetition? I don't have the answers to it, Chairperson, but in the abstract, metaphorically speaking, you know what should be ideal? If there was like a Sangoku, a national civic organization structure, these structures, these different, civil society structures should go there and then strike some sort of consensus and say, okay, for every 10 demands we make, which two from each of these structures can we go to the parliamentary committee to and say, okay, right, we understand the constraints. We want 100 things, but can you give us 25? And if they put 25 demands, it's more likely they'll get 12. If they put 100 to us, they're likely to get 4 or 5. It's overwhelming. Treasury's not going to agree. We don't know exactly how, with the limited time we have in terms of the Money Bills Act, exactly what we prioritize as well. So in short, I don't know. There should be some forum, a apart from which we have to look again at the constraints and look into reviewing the whole parliamentary program to accommodate more time for both the fiscal framework and all the appropriations bills. We tried before, Chairperson, you'll remember it didn't work. So I think we should phase things in as well. I don't know how we do it. It's an abstract thing. We need to think it through. Then the one thing we could do, Chairperson, and can't we just do this now? Can't we demand we fire some of these people? I know the labor laws that we passed, rightly, have come back to bite us, so to speak. But can't we fire a few of the DGs and really take strong positions on the ministers? I mean, how can they not spend the money? There's the example used of human settlements. I really think, Chairperson, we should be very strong on that in this report, that we want the DGs to go. Ultimately, they're the accounting officer, and we want the ministers held to account. In this situation, they can't justify. It's unconscionable, and it's unconscionable for us not to take a stronger, firm view. We also have to work with the portfolio, line portfolio committees and so on in the next term. So the next thing I'd like to say, Chairperson, we've raised this before, but as is our final report before this term ends, can't we take a much stronger view on the BIG? Right? Can't we actually do more on the BIG? Not repeat platitudes and demand that the incoming committee within 6 months pushes the majority party and those who support the BIG, I think many parties do, to ensure that it gets done. Then on cater deployment, Chairperson, isn't the time. In some or other measure, in some or other form, subtle or otherwise, there is this thing all over the world. The problem with us is not that we have a cater deployment policy, but that we ourselves abuse it. We choose people because they belong to our faction or whatever. But the principle of cater deployment is in principle something that's applied universally in some other form. There's no time to engage on it. And in fact, the DA itself does it. There are a plethora of examples. There's a whole lot of stuff that was in the media, Chairperson, when Cape Town Municipality fell under the hands of Ms. Zilla, okay? And the, so many people changed. And then they said, no, these people left because they couldn't live with the DA. So can we actually, you know what, have a more measured debate about it? Then, Chairperson, I'll stop here. There are other things. I'm making a speech, which I didn't mean to do. But really, we can't continue this process, Chairperson. I don't have the answers. Can we look into it? How do we manage this process of interaction with civil society? Finally, we as the state are increasingly elements of the state parliament and the ANC itself, acknowledging that the state is deteriorating. That we need the active participation of civil society like never before. So we need also engage with civil society far more and not see them all as anti-ANC. I mean, in fact, the values that underlie them, Chairperson, are the values of the Freedom Charter and the Constitution, almost all of them. These are progressive, largely civil society. They are our allies in securing service delivery and development. What have they dealt with? Basic service delivery. Look at the rural health thing. Look at the education thing. How can we disagree with that? Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Yunis. Comrade Tandi, I saw you also requested to be recognized on the chat, but at last your hand is up.
Chairperson, I'm sorry. Chairperson, yes. I have explained to you and the co-chair that I have to exit by 12:30. Thank you. I'm sorry about the confusion about my commitment. Sorry about that.
Okay, it's fine. Thank you. Comrade Tandi?
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, my gadget was giving me a challenge. Chair, I also appreciate the presentations, but I want to engage Ms. Higginson from Rhodes University. My understanding of the adjustment appropriations is based on the policies and the toolkit we have adopted as compiled by the OECD. And for any adjustment to take place, there's a compelling case done in MINMEX by different departments to request an adjustment. And that's why there will always be a medium-term budget policy statement to look at the fiscal framework going forward and accommodating those adjustments. Now, having listened very carefully to Ms. Higginson when she made her presentation, the insinuation is that it is not shown in documentation. So as and when quarterly reports are presented, it reflects those adjustments. So that you will not only find in the estimates of national expenditure, but it will be shown as and when you do those adjustments. And those are legal documents of government. Perhaps she wants to understand at what stage. So I wanted to elaborate further what she meant, because there will be no adjustment if it is not have been processed properly through the MINMEC and subsequent to cabinet processes and coming even before committees of parliament in this regard, the appropriations committee. Therefore, I might have misconstrued her view, and such documents are public documents for consumption. So I'll further want to engage specifically on that, because it's a policy issue that has been raised sharply here. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Chandi. I saw the hand of Comrade Kaiso. Am I correct, Secretary? Comrade Kaiso?
Yes, Chairperson, my hand was up and then lowered.
Okay. You still want to speak?
Yes. My input here, Chair, having heard all the presentation and welcome them, I don't want to repeat what Honourable Karim has said on number of cases, but I just want to go straight to the issue which was raised by Section 27 and also propose something in the next coming committee. There should be a look into it. The Section 27 raised the issue around pit latrine toilet. I think this matter has been coming up in each and every public hearing meeting. So there is always a gap of, you know, numbers of these pit latrine toilet. The department would say 500 or so, and then there's 800. So I think maybe ultimately, as these committees, there has to be a, well, let me ask Section 27, do you particularly have information as to where are these 800 toilets? If perhaps Section 27 can provide this committee with the information specifically identifying where are these 800 toilets, and perhaps to kill this issue, well, we may be able to see all the 800 at a go during oversight, but at least there must be an identification and do some oversight in future around what is known as a pit latrine toilet. Perhaps we might be saying pit latrine toilet is something else, but then if we've got an information where is the pit latrine, go to pit latrine and identify it. And obviously, I suspect where you see pit latrine, you also see a poor school structure. Because I don't understand, to fix a pit latrine, to fix a dilapidated school also, and then you are also unable to fix a pit latrine. There are a number of things which are shaping there. So maybe it's better that at some stage the committee has to go look at what is pit latrine there, which has been referred to. Sometimes people don't believe what we hear here in this meeting, that there are 800 pit latrines. So the basic education perhaps might be having a different number. So we definitely have to look this in future. Yes, of course, I agree with Comrade Karim with the issue of cadre deployment. It's a permanent future policy of the ANC. But from the DA, Ockham, yes. Honorable Ocamp, you better forget, my friend. This is a permanent future policy of the African National Congress. So it is there. You know as well as the DA has its own KDA deployment there. So I don't know which one are you referring to, because you should be starting with your own KDA deployment in the Western Cape. Thank you very much.
I see the hand of Honorable Ocamp, and unfortunately, my Honorable Member, I know you want to respond to, you are triggered by what Honorable Kaiso has said, and I'm discouraging dialogue because there are still other people who want to speak. Can I humbly request that you don't respond to what he has said? You will have an opportunity to debate these policies of your own parties in the House. Can I request now Honorable Chairperson Sheng Baba to come in?
Honorable Chairperson Masango, thank you very much for chairing the session. And let me also thank the presenters and emphasize what honorable members have said before me, that their presentations and their interactions are really most welcome. As Honorable Karim was saying, there's definitely no way we can disagree with most of the things they are saying. It may be a question of when are they doable? Can we do them now? Or perhaps we can do them tomorrow? What are the constraints at the moment? The twin things, more infrastructure at schools, more people in hospitals, the basic income grant, and so on. We are agreeing on all those things. Just to emphasize that our approach to the budget is to try first and foremost to take care of the most vulnerable. Hence, 60% of consolidated expenditure goes to the social wage, which are the things that were spoken about here. So we agree 100%. But here is the constraint, as you know, in budget, they're always constrained, is the money that we are having. The money that we are having, the resources that we are having. The only way we fund this the budget is through the is through taxes that we get from people, and secondly we go out and borrow money to try and cover the deficit. As we are talking now, everybody says that the debt is too high. We also know that the economy is not So the only way is to our fiscals will be in serious trouble. That is the things that are being raised at the thing at the video. But it is constrained that we can't control. So the focus is somewhere else. What happened to your fiscal is no longer sustainable. What happened just
we're losing you, Cheng. You are frozen now. Oh, are you back?
I'm back, okay. Yes. I was cut. But I think where I was saying that what ends up happening is that you lose your sovereignty, and then you have got the Bretton Woods institutions, your IMF coming in, literally taking over. And what we refer to as structural adjustment programs of the IMF, when you don't have a say in your budget at that time. The things, the 60% that you are saying were spending on social wage is the first area that they look at, and they may cut that thing to 20%. So that's why it's better that we ourselves take the pain But I'll be the first one to say to you, colleagues, presenters, that all these cuts that you spoke about, the increases that are below inflation, and therefore in real terms you are having a decrease in the allocation, can't be a permanent feature of our budget and spending. So we should go to the things that we need to do. Except for COSATU, I don't think I heard from any of the presenters saying for us to be able to do this more revenue, for us to be able to get more revenue, we need the economy to grow and grow. In which that I would like to leave with you all the presenters that please spend some time on saying how can we or different players and economic agents make sure that we push the economic growth to the levels that are envisaged by NDP, that is 5% and above. The thing, how do you make sure that ERP agreeing that there are all the challenge that we are all facing, and I think that's what we should be focusing on, is that how do we make sure that the economy grows and grows inclusively? Well, I think coming to the question that changed, then that I think I'm leaving with you. Again, let me agree with public service and talk about transparency. You see, when you are not transparent, that you ask people don't jump into, they think that there is something fishy in there, even if there's none. So I think that as a committee must note that there's this thing. Let's be transparent. Let people understand exactly. Let's be information that we rely on to come to certain determinations. That should be a public available information. I don't understand why should it be difficult for people to access that information. Yes, the question. I think that the question of transparency was raised by Public Service Accountability Monitor and repeated by the Western Cape Children's Commission. I think for me, more than questions, Honorable Chairperson, is this thing that I would like to hear the presenter touching on this one quickly, but I know that such things don't have quick solutions. But for me, it's more of a challenge that we spend some more time. That what do we do to let's concentrate on the revenue side, because as things stand now, we're more looking at the expenditure side without addressing the revenue side. But thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Shenye. You struggled today with your network. I just hope that the presenters have heard all what you have raised, very important points there. I will add my few questions specifically to equal education. My first question is to equal education is that with regard to the recommendations made by them, by the equal education, which suggests that the committee must reverse the cuts and ring fence the children's budget. Having said that, my question is, should there be the question should be whether the equal education could assist this committee or these committees by merely identifying the specifics in terms of the budget cuts that you are advising us to identify or to recommend for reversal in the 2024 budget. So we hear what you're saying about the ring-fencing cutting budget, but where do you recommend budget should be cut? Because I want to believe that, as my colleagues, honorable members have said, all these issues that have been raised, they are very important. They speak to the citizens of South Africa. So maybe you can assist us by advising, identifying which areas. The next question is with regard to the school's infrastructure. I think Honorable Kaiso have spoken at length about it. The letter from Ubong Musa School. This is one of many cases that need to be handed over to the sector committees and the Department of Basic Education. You know, some of the things they are directed to us. We welcome those concerns, but I think we will need to, as the committee, as much as we receive this. The concerns and recommendations, we will have to raise these issues or refer these issues to the relevant departments and to the committees. So I'm selling the idea that all these questions or these areas of concern that are specific in nature to sector departments, we will be dealing with an overall budget as appropriations. But in terms of the departmental budget on the expenditure, I think I will request I will request, with your permission or your consent, honorable members, that we request the secretariat to refer the matters to relevant sector committees, so that they can engage the departments as and when they deal with the budget. My last but one question is that this committee will of course pass this Division of Revenue Bill, and we are aware, as you have raised and I have also raised, that it contains education infrastructure grants as well as school infrastructure backlog grants. And these grants are meant to deal with such things. If you can go back to our recommendations to the House as appropriations, both houses, in our recommendations all the time, we even give time frames for relevant departments, nationally, provincially, and also at some point where we see it fit, we say they must work together with the Department of Treasury. A very important question that has been raised by Comrade Tandi, issues that are being dealt with are processed in MINMEC and the Cabinet. So we will play our role, but we don't want to downplay what you have raised. Very important points, but after raising them, recommend how best you think we can implement your recommendations. My last question is still to Equal Education. I want to know what is your view on school rationalization policy, which is implemented by the Department of Basic Education. Again, sector department is the one that is implementing that. But to us, what is your view or your recommendation or your advice? How can it be improved to ensure a smooth transition? The smooth transition. I'm saying all these things, requesting advices and recommendations, so that when we, if members agree, we refer these issues to the sector department for processing. We also convince ourselves and are happy or are satisfied about the issues that you have raised. I don't think all of you presenters will want to speak to these issues because some were direct to others. I'm going to do something that I've never done before. I'll request the presenters, the stakeholders, raise your hands, those who want to respond, who feel that the questions which were raised by the members here need you, or I will, okay, thank you. Thank you for your cooperation. Equal education.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. I note a couple of direct questions to us, and then there were more general ones that I suppose we could give an input into. So perhaps I will start with the one general sort of sentiment highlighted by Honorable Buthelezi, and I think that's where me and Honorable Chair, we differ on agreement or certain principles. So it's highly problematic for us with the question about where the money must come from, you know, the Robin Peter to PayPal argument starts to manifest. And I always answer, and I'm going to maintain our position that we are not economists. Hence, we are not giving a view on the fiscal framework and talking about taxation and what have you. If we did that, it would be disingenuous because we are coming at a place of not expertise or lived experience or knowledge, and we might be misleading and probably contributing to misinformation. Our role is to highlight the impact of the social impact of the budget, keeping in mind that the budget itself is a tool for transformation. And so the recommendations we have made is based on lived experiences, critical consideration of a whole lot of complexities, but we do not in any way think it's a simplistic, easy to do sort of recommendations. If it was, we would have implemented it. There would be no need for, lamenting about it. And so really we've highlighted important areas for the committee and all of government to look at in quote unquote doing their job or in considering in doing that responsibility and duty. So we can't speak on where the money comes from and all those things, but we acknowledge the complexities and very important decisions that ultimately comes out as the budget. But perhaps as an addition to that is also the issue that, I mean, this public consultation we're having is almost after the fact. Budgetary decisions have already been made, and as Honorable Chair was mentioning, that the committee is going to approve this division of revenue bill. So it almost seems as if, you know, we are speaking about something that is a really already done deal. So it becomes a little bit difficult to know how we are going to influence policy decisions before it becomes a final product. And these are some of the teething problems that we need to unpack in this public participation processes going forward, and to make sure that the budgetary process is actually reflective and speaks to the lived experiences of the people that it is meant to serve. Coming specifically to the question, I was not clear on what exactly, Honorable Chair, you wanted to know about specifics about ring fencing, the children's budget, and obviously reversing their cuts. But I think throughout our presentation, what we are highlighting is that South Africa has made a commitment to the UN Children's Commission that they are ring fencing the children's budget. So anything that touches on children's rights should essentially be protected and not be subjected to austere decisions. And so in our presentation, we highlighted specific ones that speak specifically to schooling, because that is our primary sort of area of experience and expertise and the area of concern for our membership. So when we look at infrastructure grants, when we look at teacher provisioning, things that directly impact the outcomes that learners are supposed to enjoy in terms of their constitutional right to quality basic education. If you read our written submission, and we provided a committee with the presentation as well, you will see all those specific ones. It has also been highlighted by Section 27. Specific ones have been reiterated by the Budget Social Justice. So it's holistically anything that speaks to basic education or has an impact on the delivery of education services is a children's issue indirectly and therefore needs to be protected. And we have a constitutional sort of policy that basic education is an immediately realizable right. So that means when everything else is, we are making decisions, it should be on top of the priority to be able to safeguard that right. It's not a right that must be realized progressively at a later stage. It is a now right. And so ring fencing the children's budget or protecting any amount of money that deals directly with that kind of right must be a priority for this committee, for Treasury, all of government, really. I take note of your comment about some of the issues not being the mandate or the purview of this committee. So as a civil society organization really championing education rights, we don't only deal with this specific committee or parliament. We deal with all the stakeholders across the board. So the specific letters that we are showing you an example of have been presented to specific education departments and provincial legislatures in considering how they tackle this issue. So we engage with all stakeholders, money stakeholders, policy and implementation stakeholders as well. So we take your point and be rest assured of all of these things that we are sharing with you today. In terms of our view, well, let me basically touch on the school infrastructure as an example of one of the ways we see children's rights being eroded. And you know, when we think about education, we tend to concentrate on the pedagogical implications of it. Are there enough teachers? Are there qualified teachers, textbooks? But we are not looking at the environmental and spatial issues that actually create environments that are making in the sector. And so infrastructure has very direct and indirect impact on achieving educational outcomes. And therefore, when we talk about funding the sector broadly, we look at it in holistically, and we look at it in the different conditional grants that also contribute to it. And we find that most of the problem comes from the infrastructure aspect because of the historical backlogs that plague the sector that really tries to undermine the gains that we have made. So it's almost as if we are taking one step forward and six steps back. And so if we do not concurrently address the interventions, it will almost as if like we are not doing anything, and we will keep coming back to this committee and other places to highlight this issue because it is not going away. And this is a real concern for the learners themselves and for our society if we are planning to grow the economy, for instance. And then on the final question about school rationalization. So as a principal, we are not against school rationalization. It is the process of school rationalization that raises concerns and problematic aspects when it comes to implementing that policy. So I think the failure on the part of the department is failing to do proper needs analysis and public consultation with community members to identify and to agree on which schools are not viable any longer.
My apologies. Please pardon me. Can we, to all those who are going to respond, not start the presentation afresh, please, with your respect? Just highlight issues that have been raised. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. So I am responding to the questions that you have highlighted. So school rationalization is not bad in itself. It is the process around it that creates the confusion and the difficulty. So when public participation or community consultation is not done properly, you get resistance and therefore it becomes a failure and you find it that there's a lot of difficulty in moving forward. So the departments of basic education and provincial departments need to do proper needs analysis, proper community engagement before they proceed to rationalize schools that they deem to be unviable and therefore a drain on their resources to be able to implement the policy of school rationalizations effectively. Otherwise, what happens is that community members will resist and then we still have schools that are quote-unquote unviable, but they are still requiring government support in terms of money investment and also infrastructure development. I hope I have answered and touched on all the questions that were posed to us specifically. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comrade Matthew, over to you.
No, thanks, Chen. Yeah, thanks, members. Let me just gallop quickly through it. I think just to appreciate the questions members raised, and I think it's always positive when we're largely on the same page in terms of what are the solutions, with some differences, fine. I think, Chair, just Honourable Molotani on the delinquent municipalities, and he's right. I mean, the Free State Northwest is the epicentre of local government disintegration. It's quite scary, to be honest. We've had quite a few interventions as COSATU and with our affiliate SAMU trying to not just throw complaints, but to say what are the practical things. There's been countless marches, meetings of mayors. I know last week on the issue of Matcha Bang in the Free State, which is really a mess. We had a meeting with the Minister of Cogta, the President of Salga, trying to resolve the issues, countless interventions at the Botla and other places. But I think fundamentally, look, that's putting plaster on a wound, to be honest. We need a sustainable solution. I think we need to have a bit of a discussion about what is the right local government model, what we can afford, because right now the stats don't lie, the AG and the Treasury reports don't lie. It's a very scary thing. And I think it'd be even more complicated to fix an ESCOM. So rather intervene now before things just get out of hand. I mean, I think to Honorable Okam's question about candidate deployment, yes, look, I mean, all political parties across the world do it. I think the point is that within South Africa, we have public service regulations which specify to be a utilities manager at a municipality, you should have an engineering background. To be head of electricity, you should have some electrical engineering background, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is that we have people at municipalities who ignore that, who choose to appoint a friend or a family or whatever. That's the problem. So the problem is not the law, it's about us abiding by it. We've had at times affiliates also trying to intervene. So Nahau, for example, has intervened in one department of national government where they raised concerns about how a director general was appointed, feeling wasn't, for lack of a better term, fit for purpose. Chair, I think, look, for us, I think we all agree the debt level is very concerning. I think especially the debt trajectory, which is more concerning. Debt level is not itself a major issue, but it's about the growth in it. And I think for us, the fundamental solution, as I think all members are saying, is grow the economy. One can cut their budget to one's heart's delight. One can pickpocket nurses. And those are easy, low-hanging fruits. There's a bit of lazy shortcuts. But it's not a solution. You'll have to keep cutting. So there's a DA bill, for example, before SCOF, which says cut the wage bill by 5% every year. If you take that kind of an approach of just cutting, 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 what you will do is to spark a brain drain from the public service of skilled employees like doctors, nurses, teachers, police officers, etc., who go to better jobs in the private sector, lucrative jobs overseas, and that's going to make it worse. So we have to grow the economy, and I think for us, the Honourable Okamp and Honourable Sheng and other members, it's about giving support to ESCOM. There's been good progress. Let's enhance the support. We have seen some initial turnaround in the transit. We need to do much more, and similarly around PRASA. And the investments at SARS, the remarkable turnaround there, shows you that if we invest in public services, we can get the results. Appoint competent management, et cetera, fill critical vacancies, invest in IT, you can improve. We need to do similarly with regards to the police, to Home Affairs, to the schools, to the CETAs, to the labor market institutions like the CCMA, et cetera. Because society benefits when you invest in quality public services. The businesses benefit, workers benefit. I think, Chair, what we really hope to overall comes question is that, so there is a good infrastructure program in the budget. Let's see if we can implement it. There is green shoots around ESCOM. We'd hope for a bit more support for Transnet. We'd hope for much more around PRASA and the SOEs. There is the intervention programs around local government. We hope those will bear fruit. But we had hoped to see more investment in the public services, particularly our frontline services. Chair, you know, the presidential employment stimulus and the SOD grant have really been wonderful interventions by government over the past four years. We don't know why we're not extending those programs. It's that the budget is cutting them all the time, and for us, that's madness. When you have an unemployment rate of 41%, a youth unemployment rate of 60%, the SOD grant has been a wonderful intervention with all of its issues, but we have failed to adjust it once for inflation at least for 4 years. So we would support Honourable Karim to say, can we now cross that bridge, transform it into a BIG? Maybe small steps, that's fine, but let's move that direction because we're at the precipice of moving towards it. We'd hope really to see more progress share and support given to our law enforcement in addition to the additional police officers to turn the fight against crime and corruption. And again, SARS is an example, but again, we're not sure why we're not simply writing a blank check for SARS because SARS has done really well to increase tax compliance. So we should be simply saying to the commissioner, let's have a discussion. Can we get to a 70% tax compliance rate in the next 2 years? And what do you need to achieve that? On the wage bill, Chair, look, the wage bill, despite, slogans by some, is not out of control. It's decreased from 35 to 31.7% in the budget. And again, so the issue is not the wage bill. The issue is about growing the economy. I'll just check quickly. I'll try to gallop through it. On transit, I think basically what we've done is to do at ESCOM is what we need to do in transit. Appointing competent manager, there's a new CEO. She's good. We hope she'll do well. Give them more support around the debt relief. And of course, that can assist them to invest more in infrastructure and machinery, some of the simple things as cranes or tugboats. But we also need to do more to assure the staff that their jobs are secure. There has been some progress around giving staff incentive bonuses like at Durban to increase the moving containers. We think that can really be a game changer, but we also need to invest in the skills of staff. But basically, engage the staff so that they can, because ultimately they'll be the ones to turn transit around. Transit freight rail, I think, is much more scary. I don't know how we do the copper cable theft, which is crippling it. Yes, we need to partner with security like it's been done around the Richards Bay coal corridor. I think we need to ultimately find an alternative replacement to copper because it's almost impossible to keep up with the criminal syndicates. Chair, just quickly towards the end, I mean, the informal settlements, I'm not sure, Chair, you know, the 45% under expenditure, is that the reason why they're cutting the budget from human settlements around it and they're shifting it towards local government? But I think ultimately we need to make sure that that money is spent because it can't be right that we have money and it's not spent for such a crying need. But we should be revisiting our approach to housing and informal settlement and rather be giving people land, service plots, and give people access to housing subsidies to build their own homes because the quality of our RDP homes, to be honest, is not good. I think lastly, Chair, Honourable Schenger raises the issue about the debt versus growth. And I think for us, it's about growing the economy. It's about smart expenditure. That's why we support, you know, tapping into the Reserve Bank reserves as a once-off, again, but to assist Eskom or Transnet, because that'll have a multiply effect in the economy. But we agree with Honorable Shenge, we can't go to the IMF. We'd rather fix our country ourselves, take the medication, but do it in a smart way, not in a reckless, blunt way of the IMF. And Shenge, Honorable Shenge is right. It's a revenue crisis, not an expenditure crisis. So we have to fix the revenue. And then last, Chair, to Honorable Karim. Look, I think there are green shoots, Chair. I think we've seen on Eskom remarkable improvements, still fragile. Transnet, there is some improvement in the last 2 months. SARS has been a wonderful turnaround story. We have managed to see unemployment falling by 5% last year. Let's see how we maintain that momentum. And, you know, government, with all of its messiness and society, all our drama, we did remarkably well collectively as government, as parliament, business, labor, society, to manage COVID-19. We did far better than industrialized countries like the US. But we need to be a bit more smart. And I think Honorable Karim is right about executive accountability. I think parliament, to be honest with you, is far too soft on our DGs, our ministers, our MECs, our mayors, etc. But let me stop there, Chair. I know I've long abused your hospitality, but thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Matthew. I see the hand of Sidiso.
Thank you.
27. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will try and keep this brief because I think other participants have already expressed their views, but also I think Honorable Karim is on his way out, so I'll try it because I do want to respond to some of that. So the first thing I want to respond to is basically the conversation about public participation, which Liz has touched on, just to alert this committee that there were pre-budget consultations that were piloted the year before last. So there were two pilots on that, along with by National Treasury, with the Fiscal Openness Accelerator. However, there hasn't been much movement beyond that. And so we think that both Section 27 and I think with the BJC, we think that that's a powerful intervention to ensuring that to increasing public participation, but in a more meaningful way ahead of the budget rather than what we're doing right now, even though there is some merit in doing this now. But if we are to prevent some of the repetitive, every year we come back and say the same thing, I think that's a powerful way to do that, as the budget would be better shaped by the people who are affected by it, by the people of this country. Then the next question was about the pit latrines and the numbers. So in our presentation, we had cited the over 800 schools with pit latrines in the Eastern Cape. So those were specific to the Eastern Cape. But these numbers are, I know there's contention about the numbers, DBE, the numbers of pit latrines in this country, but we use DBE's numbers. So these are publicly available, but I'm also happy to share the link in the chat, and it's also available on our written presentation that explains how many pit latrines there are in the country and where they're located. Then, again, just to respond, I think it was Honorable Buthelezi and again also Honorable Karim who is speaking about, just speaking about, so what do we do? There are constraints. So we recognize their fiscal constraints. I know Liz said that we're not economists, but we form part of the Budget Justice Coalition and many civil society organizations. We are economists. There are people with finance backgrounds and people who specialize in public finance, and they do propose alternatives, particularly to the committee, the finance committees. And some of these recommendations have actually been taken on board as part of the budget, with the budget. So one of them being the GFECRA, so the gold and foreign exchange account, gender responsive budgeting, for instance, and those do actually get implemented. And I think that's why as civil society, we find value in advocating through these platforms, like through engaging with parliament. So yes, the issue is definitely on the revenue side. And so maybe the revenue side is impacting. We're struggling to collect revenue as much as we should. But even the recommendations that we make, for instance, like participatory human rights impact assessments and issues on understanding and procurement, those are ways to ensure that even in the worst economic climate of areas where there's low economic growth or periods of low economic growth, those are still constitutionally protected rights that we're talking about. And as such, they need to be protected. And so really our recommendations are, we know that we're in tough decisions need to be made, but how can we make sure that these tough decisions still foreground human rights? And so our recommendations are not to say that, oh, it's easy, just do X, Y, and Z, but are saying that these are the ways to advance the power of the budget to actually alleviate the suffering that is experienced in this country so that we can ensure that these rights are protected even during times of poor economic performance. So, yeah, I think that I have covered my answers, question, so thank you.
Thank you, Section 27, Christina from WCCC. Over to you, madam.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, for this opportunity. I want to applaud the suggestion that you made that we become specific in what we mean by child rights budgeting. I want to implore you to give that instruction to the National Treasury. Ourselves as Chapter 9s, and I'm sure civil society, would help in the technical exercise to determine that. I want to give Leander just 1 minute to say something.
Thank you very much for the platform. I was very happy to be a part of this session today. The speeches, or let me rather say the reports that were given by everyone were very lovely, and I love the fact that a lot of platforms actually considered children. They spoke a lot about education, nutrition, mental health, which is things that do affect children. However, in the speeches, there are words that they used that are very complex, and I believe that South Africans would not be able to understand that. So if we would maybe use terms that are more simplified in order for everyone to understand, that would be lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. A user-friendly language for everybody to understand. The next person is Lisa, from which organization, stakeholder? Lisa?
Thank you. It's Lisa from the Public Service Accountability Monitor.
Okay.
I just wanted to respond briefly. Just to emphasize, I think it was said by one of the members that when information isn't available, we're sort of left speculating. So with the budget and the MTBPS, we receive comprehensive documentation. We return from Cape Town with bags of books with clear explanations of the choices and trade-offs. And I think what we're arguing is that there is just insufficient information that accompanies these additional adjustments we are seeing happening more frequently. And, you know, in very briefly, what can be done is just as a minimum to include an explanatory note with the bill so that it's clear why the adjustments are being made. If I could just hand over to our program head to just come in and elaborate a little bit further on the framework in response to the question from Honorable Tobias. That's the piece of court. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa. Chair, I hope it's appropriate. I step in very briefly.
Yes, Ms. Kota.
Okay, thank you. I'll be quick. Thank you for the questions and the inputs, and in particular, the question that I'll be responding to is from Honorable Tobias. I think as a starting point, we are perhaps some of the biggest champions of the levels of transparency that the National Treasury has over years shown, and the kind of stewardship around the public finance context. So as a starting point, ours is not to question that. And in fact, it is to say that one of the risks specifically of the second, you know, lack of information around the second adjustment appropriations is that over time we can see a creep away from levels of transparency and a deeper fragmentation of the budget process. So, for instance, in the context of the appropriation making an increase into the National Prosecuting Authority, something we support and something, in fact, in June or at the next appropriation sitting, we're very keen to make submissions on and have done in the past. But a concern of ours is that, on the one hand, as you know, Mr. Parks from Kusati indicated in his presentation, we are encouraged by an increase, for example, to the NPA. But the problem is that without the clarity of what that is, the basis on which the second adjustments appropriation bill is approved into an act is a little bit hazy. And so we are arguing that whether it's for civic actors or, in fact, the ultimate approvers of the budget in the context of Parliament, there needs to be very concrete justifications of that. On the OECD aspect of things, absolutely. We respect the 10 principles of budgeting, one of which very much relates to what we're trying to emphasize today, which is about budget credibility and ensuring an open and clear reporting timeframes and integrity of the budget process. So our concern is perhaps a more systemic one, a longer term one, and highlighting risks that we foresee in the context of budgeting. And lastly, to say we really would also want to reiterate the point about in-year reporting. So Honourable Tobias mentioned the quarterly reporting context. That for us is really important, really meaningful. Of course, at this point, you know, we would expect, and we put this in our longer submission, that the relevant accounting officer will come back to Parliament and explain what will happen or what the reasons behind this. But again, our point is this must, you know, there must be a preemptive explanation in order for the committee to be satisfied that these, in fact, are meaningful. We do also noting that there are the Treasury team members on the call. We also want to call on the committee to place emphasis, one, around the importance of availability of this information. So regardless of what we're saying at this point, it is that the Section 32 reports, for instance, and the various in-year quarterly reports that the Treasury and departments produce, we would want to make sure that a platform like Vuleka Mali that the National Treasury and civil society have championed is strengthened, is made more robust, and in fact that we don't see regressions. So our concern right now is about potential regressions in a context that we've been seeing some improvements around fiscal transparency, around policy coherence, and around budget credibility. And I think Honourable Buthelezi's point is well received. It isn't that necessarily it's immediately corruption, but in fact our point is that perception is just as important, and so the transparency levels are fundamental, particularly in adjustments to the budget after the fact. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Paulos.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm trying to answer the question in relation to the query or suggestion made by Honourable Yunus Karim about a civil society forum or some form of representativity. I don't know where Honourable Karim is coming from, but in the late 90s and early 2000s, when I worked for the Parliamentary Office of KASATU, a position that comrade Matthew Parks holds, we were part of the People's Budget Campaign, comprised of SANGOKO, the South African Council of Churches, and KASATU. And I think the Budget Justice Coalition grew from there. And in fact, the BJC, as we matured in terms of our institutional governance arrangements, we had regular meetings, we had AGMs, we have huge efforts to be accountable and transparent among 21 different civil society organizations across the spectrum. So to be frank, I see ourselves as a coalition of NGOs and CBOs from a diverse background that has institutionally even gone beyond the heady days in the late 90s and early 2000s that the People's Budget Campaign initiated. And I think we grew from there. So I just wanted to make that a matter of record. We are deeply appreciative of the opportunities that your committee and other committees in Parliament make. And many of us are familiar with the processes required. But I think this suggestion of a CSO forum, well, then what is the BJC? I needed to put that on record. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you.
The next speaker is Zimbini Madikiza.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and I am from the Rural Health Advocacy Project.
Okay.
I think there were two direct questions to the Rural Health Advocacy Project. I think the first one was coming from Honorable Moletsani. I hope the Ibiza Kaku Hello Fan. I think with regards to the ESSA budget available or allocated for employment of more doctors, what we are saying there for us is that an assumption is that this budget will might only allow an additional of 200 doctors. That is fine. But what we are saying is that we need these doctors to be allocated to rural hospitals to ensure that those in greatest need are prioritized. We need to know as well as to the recent filing of the doctors, where are they actually allocated, so that we know that there is equitable share of these doctors in terms of the areas that need the most. And also with regards to the 2030 National Human Resources Health Strategy, I think there also that could be an initiative or a solution that could be helpful in terms of having transparent engagements with provinces in terms of developing HR plans for human resources, the human resource plans, and it must be an inclusive engagement together with the civil society as well and the province duty bearers, so as to make it a point that it's prioritized, the area that is in need is actually prioritized, and we know that rural communities are the ones that are actually suffering the injustice in South Africa. And I think also to speak on, I think it was Honorable Willie, I think I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, with regards to the progress for district health programs, I think the district health barometer does bring a picture of where we are in terms of the provision of primary healthcare system. It brings in the detailed report, and I mean there's a new one now, which is the digital health barometer that was launched on the 28th of February. Still shows a picture that is not so nice, because if you go to the reproductive health and child and maternal indicator, the first line that tells you that there is a decline. So the picture is still not so great, but there are solutions that can be put in place in terms of making a point that when umakhulu okanye umntana esiya eclinic, uyakwazi ukufika ikhona imedication. That will be a solution that can also help in making a point that they don't have to come again the second day because they didn't get medication. So prioritizing primary health care means that services are available at clinics and at district hospitals. That is the most important thing, is to say, yes, we are saying budget, and we're saying primary health care, but what is it that we're talking about? We're talking about people must get the services. They must enjoy their constitutional health rights. And I mean, for this to happen, I think it was mentioned briefly by Honorable Karim, the issue of monies that are not spent and stuff like that. So what we are saying is that we need empathetical and ethical leaders who are actually decision makers, who will be able to not view accountability as an attack, but to view accountability as a solution to the social justice we are seeing. So in closing, my final point there is that the coordination of resources is one of the important things. When we say resources, we mean, you know, the money, the funds, the healthcare workforce, the medication, and so forth and so forth. It's very important for transparency in terms of planning. We also recommend that it would be helpful to say when the National Department of Health is doing the proposals of asking money and stuff like that, include civil society, even at local level, in terms of civil society to be included in planning of all the proposals and the implementation plans, which means coordination is key. And goes.
Have we lost you? Are you still on the platform? Are you done?
Remember, Kobin.
Okay, thank you.
I hope they're done.
Yeah, it was abrupt. I thought you were still continuing.
Yeah,
but
we
it's
have
fine.
Load shedding. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Comrade Tandi, do you want to have a parting words?
Yes, thanks very much, Chair. Chair, if I'm misconstruing the point, I'll be forgiven. As far as I understand, the response is that specific accounts are not necessarily transparent, and NPA in this case was referred to. Now it brought me to a situation where I remembered when I used to chair the Standing Committee on Defence, the Speaker will decide on a particular report whether it will be disclosed based on policy and where to direct it. So I just wanted the presenter to be specific so that we understand whether there's a specific budget, whether either by the security cluster that she refers to that is not transparent, so that as we engage, we know what to engage on. And we look at the modalities and the mechanisms in place that allows that to happen. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Comrade Tandi. One last response. That clarity is a clarity-seeking question so that we can be empowered when we engage, because we're still having another meeting as part of the process as we process this bill. From our side in SOP, we still have to engage and present to provinces as well.
Thank you, Tisha. Shall I?
Okay. In brief, please, madam.
Okay, thanks, Chair. I appreciate Honourable Tobias's follow-up question. Our particular point of emphasis or example was focused on the NPA, given that it is one of the entities that's set to receive additional funds. So in the second adjustments appropriation bill that we're focusing on, there's a figure of approximately 40 million, if I'm not mistaken. And our position there is not so much that there is lack of transparency in the tabling or in the budget context of the NPA or the relevant vote, but our point in this particular instance is that where there is no explanation aside from that this is to is allocated to compensation of employees, I believe is the line, it's very difficult to justify and kind of better understand what that is. So the example or the recommendation that we raise or that we provide in our submission is to say Treasury guidelines, for instance, that are provided to departments, as well as those that support the annual estimates of national but the adjusted appropriations, the national adjustments each year, there are very clear stipulations on the degree of information that must be provided, which includes, for instance, the reasons for deferments or violence and so on. So what our suggestion is, our recommendation is that similar to that, the second adjustments appropriation bill in particular should have similar obligations to explain in detail where that's going, what it's for. And so what we're saying is that there is, in this particular example, We're seeing a greater frequency of these later of these adjustments, but without the requisite level of information in order to inform approval or withdrawal or declining, by a committee such as this. So it isn't to emphasise, Honourable Tobias, it isn't that we are saying there is some particular secrecy in the context of the NPA or the relevant vote. But in fact, what we're saying is that the bill itself must be accompanied by a clear articulation of what these adjustments are for and why they are being made, after the fact. And so we're not against adjustments to the budget, of course. We're very much in support of a dynamic and flexible budget that adapts to the needs of the context, but that must be accompanied by very clear explanatory notes. I hope that makes it a little bit clearer.
Okay, I hope so as well. I think by now we have come to the last part, which is the closing. There's no other item, ne? Estelle?
For the last part, that is announcements, we can quickly run through. Yes. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Yes. We received an apology from the Honorable Kwankwa, who is held up in another meeting in Parliament. Then an announcement is that we are having the other joint meeting on Friday for the public hearings on the GFECRA bill. It will start at 8 o'clock in the morning. Thank you, Chairperson. Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have come to the end of the meeting, and I want to thank everybody who participated, honorable members for being here. We will meet again on Friday as announced to deal with the other business of Parliament. Thank you so much.
Chairperson?
Who's that?
Mutile.
Oh, okay, Sheng.
I'm sorry for that. I'm not sure whether all the members of the public who are here will also be making presentations on the GFECRA bill. I don't think so. Or in the light of that, I just have one comment to make for those, because if they are not there, the GFECRA, it may be the last time that they are interacting, at least with our committee, Standing Committee on Appropriations, in this administration. Just to say on behalf of the committee, thank you very much for being the voice of the voiceless, because the issues that are being raised, that you are raising, these are the issues which affect people on the ground, which affect people in Mahlabathini, in Mpumbu, Kamhlanga, and all those places who can't be here, and they are raising their issues. Please don't be discouraged. You must also look at the reports that we write as committees. The issues that you are raising here, you'll find that they also get themselves in those reports, and those are reports which are adopted by Parliament. But I just want to say thank you for always having taken time as we deal with separate bills and come and represent many people who can't be here because of many constraints, especially around the resources. But to really thank you, and Chairperson, I just wanted to make that comment in case others don't come to the GFECRA presentation on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Buthelezi Shenge. You represented us well. Can I now officially close the meeting? And we will see each other, those who will be there on Friday. And for those who will not be there, go well and keep safe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Adios.
Thank you.
Long live the Chair.
Long live.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radlebo
Hantad.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tutoit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Lebohan Name.